his arms slipping around the man's neck, his eyes skipping to a wink of metal at the man's left hip. Chris's hand darted in a flash. The gun was in his fist, and he was jamming the muzzle to the old man's temple. "Get away from me! Get away from me! Get away!" "No, Chris! No, no!" A chorus of voices, boys and girls, rasps of metal against leather, the sounds of handguns being drawn, the unmistakable clack of a rifle bolt. The voices were still jabbering, overlapping, everyone talking at the same time. "Chris, don't! Chris, it's all right! You're safe, Chris, you're safe!" One boy, louder than the rest, booming from behind the rifle, "Put the gun down! Put it down! Drop it! Drop it! No, Jayden!" It was the old man, his voice surprisingly strong. "Everyone, stay calm! Give him a moment to... But I've got the shot!" Jayden sang. "I've got the shot! Jayden, no!" The girl's voice was familiar, and then Chris had it. "Hannah! Chris!" Hannah said. "Please put the gun down!" "All of you, just stay back!" Chris cried, except the words now came in a harsh, grinding choke. A lone candle gave off a thin, uncertain light, but it was enough for him to see that he stood in a tangle of linen and down comforter, half on, half off a bed, and that he was completely naked. "Where am I?" It wasn't a dream. Hurt. I was hurt bad. I was bleeding. I felt... He'd felt that black creep through his chest, squeeze his heart. I felt myself die. I was dying. I was... No, he couldn't think about that. Get out. He had to get out. He still had the old man by the neck, but his eyes jumped from face to face. Jayden, Hannah, two other boys, and then the long rectangle of this room with its slanted ceiling and trio of windows. Attic or second story. Bedroom. A closed door, the way out, was to his left, but the others were blocking his way. There came a series of muffled barks, and then someone at the door. "Are you all right? Is he okay? What's happening?" "No, no, wait!" Hannah made a grab, but a little girl suddenly squirted through. "Chris?" The girl's face was pinched with anxiety. Her blue eyes widened, and he understood what he must look like. Naked, in a frenzy, a gun in one hand and an old man in a chokehold. By her side, a dog smaller than a shepherd and with sable markings watched him through a black mask. "Chris, it's all right," the little girl said. "Remember me?" "Yes." Chris gulped against a sudden wave of vertigo. "No, can't black out again." He fought to clear his head. You're Ellie."
"Right. And this is Mina, my dog."
Relief flooded Ellie's face.
"We kept you warm, remember? We rescued you. You're safe now."
"Safe?" He heard the whip of his fear. His arm tightened around the old man's neck. "I'm not safe. Leave me alone, all of you. Just stay away. Christopher." The old man wasn't fighting, but instead stroking the arm Chris had locked around his neck the way you might soothe a frightened animal.
"Christopher, I know this is confusing. You're scared. Put down the gun before you hurt someone."
"No." But Chris felt the scrape of panic falter. He was starting to lose it, his weird strength dribbling away. "Who are you people? Where am I?"
"You're safe,"
Hannah said from a swirl of shadow, or that may have been his vision beginning to dim.
"Chris," she said, "let us help you."
"Help?" His laugh was weak and strangled. "You tried to kill me." "I have to get out of here." He took a swaying half step. His legs were suddenly wooden. The gun was growing unbelievably heavy, as weighty as a boulder, and he understood that in 2 or 3 seconds he would faint. "Please," he groaned, "let me go. I don't want to hurt anybody. I don't..." With no warning at all, his strength fled as if he'd been unplugged. His knees buckled. From somewhere distant, Chris heard the thud as the gun hit the floor. There was nothing in his hands now, not even the old man.
"You tried to kill me. You tried. Oh, God."
His eyes rolled. There was no more light and nothing to see, and he was hurtling fast in a black swoon.
"Quick, catch him,"
someone said. He thought it might be Ellie. "Don't let him fall."
"Chris?"
A voice from the dark.
"Chris, answer me. Are you okay?"
I don't know.
His tongue was bloated, his mouth numb. His chest was heavy, a huge weight pressing him down, down,
down into the black. I'm on the snow again. I'm under the trap. No! When he tried to turn his head toward the voice, his neck locked tight. Don't kill me again, please. I don't want to die.
Shh. Don't be afraid. I'm here now, Chris. I won't leave you.
A hand, strong and sure, cupped his cheek.
Open your eyes. It's time to come back. It's time to see.
I can't, he was shivering. I don't want to see.
You have to. No more hiding in the shadows.
The voice was calm but remorseless.
You're not 8 anymore. Come on. Come back now.
But his lids were lifting, the darkness peeling away, a film seeming to dissolve from his eyes. At first there was nothing but a glaring, bright fog, like strong light bleeding through heavy mist. Then he saw the fog curl and eddy as Peter's face pulled together, the pieces knitting from the neck up, chin and mouth, nose and forehead, but no eyes, only blanks, smooth skin over bone.
Where are your eyes? A fist of horror squeezed his heart. Peter, where?
Oh, silly me. And then the skin over Peter's sockets peeled apart. There. Better? Chris felt the scream boil up his throat and try to crash from his mouth. Peter's eyes were caves, not deep black mirrors like Jess's, but red and vast and filling fast. They brimmed in bloody rills that oozed down his cheeks and leaked over his lips. When Peter smiled, his lips skinned to reveal a bristle of too many teeth that were wet and orange. "Peek-a-boo," Peter said. Thick scarlet teardrops trembled on his upper lip to drip directly onto Chris's face and splash into his own staring eyes. There was a sound, the hiss of a snake, the boil of acid, and then the pain, and Chris was blind and he was screaming. Ah! Chris heard the cry bolt from his mouth. Christopher? Not Peter or Lena or his father, but an old man. A dry, cool palm found his forehead.
Christopher, are you back with us?
Is this another dream?
He lay absolutely still for a long moment.
A new nightmare.
He was under a thick down comforter and still mostly naked, although someone had slipped on a pair of underpants. There was also something unfamiliar around his neck.
Cord? Christopher?
Yes,
he croaked. He dragged his lids up, wincing against bright spokes of yellow-white light jabbing through two windows directly opposite the bed. He would have raised a hand to shield his eyes, but he couldn't move his arms. Sheets were noosed around his wrists, and his ankles were tethered to the bedposts.
There you are. Welcome back.
Reaching for a stoneware jug on a nightstand, the old man splashed water into a clear glass.
Thirsty?
He was about to ask why he was tied down, but then considered that if a kid had grabbed his gun, he would have done the same thing.
Is it drugged?
He rasped.
No. Here.
Slipping an arm under Chris's shoulders, the old man propped him as he drank. The water was clean and odorless and cool as a balm. He felt the chilly slide of its course from his tortured throat down the middle of his chest, and then the cold explosion in his empty stomach. When he drained the glass, the old man lowered him, then settled back into his own chair.
That should stay put. We fed you a bit of broth yesterday, so...
Yesterday?
When he ran his tongue over his still dry lips, he tasted old blood from where the skin had cracked.
How long have I been here?
In this room?
The old man laced his fingers over his stomach. His hair, which floated around his shoulders, was as snowy white as his beard, although his upper lip was bare. But the resemblance was clear, especially the eyes, which were as bright and black and keen as an old prophet's.
6 days ago. I arrived last night, just before sunset. I was here when you surfaced the first time.
He caught the emphasis.
What do you mean, in this room? Where was I before?
What do you remember?
Snow, he said hoarsely.
He didn't want to think about the dreams. The trees, spikes and green glass, and the sounds of the limbs breaking like bombs. That was the tiger trip. What else? Weight on my back, and I remember the cold, and it hurt my chest. Whenever I tried to move, I couldn't breathe, like knives. He was starting to shiver. I couldn't. Easy. The old man laid a calming hand on Chris's forearm. That's in the past. But how far in the past? 2 weeks. I've been out for 2 weeks. His heart skipped. What month is it?
It's the end of the first week of March. Take it easy, Chris. You're safe now.
That's what you keep saying. Was I in a coma? What happened to me?
You got caught in the tiger trap. Henna said you couldn't breathe, were in intense pain, had lost a tremendous amount of blood. Every time they tried to move you or the trap, it hurt.
His heaving chest was suddenly prickly with sweat. I couldn't
take it easy.
The old man patted his arm.
Slow down. I thought I was dying,
he whispered.
When Hannah gave me that water, I thought it was poison and she was trying to kill me. I guess it was all a bad dream, like the one about my dad and me and Lena and then Peter.
He didn't know whether to laugh or break into tears.
I dreamt that I died. I thought I was dead.
That's because, for all intents and purposes,
the old man said,
you were.
Chapter 56.
What? When he tried to start up from the bed, knots dug into his wrists and ankles.
What are you talking about? What are you saying?
Easy, Christopher,
the old man said.
Calm down.
Calm down?
He thought he was screaming, but he could only muster a tortured squawk. He strained against the sheets, his neck so stiff he heard the creak of bone.
You're telling me I was dead? That Hannah really poisoned me?
Yes. She wished to ease your suffering, to help you let go. She stayed with you until you slipped away. It didn't take long. You were quite weak already. If Ellie hadn't found you when she did and sent Eli for help, you might have been stone dead long before Hannah and Jaden got to you.
Ellie and her dog kept me alive. They...
His throat suddenly clogged as he collapsed back onto the bed.
They kept me warm.
Chris's eyes burned, and when he closed them, he felt a tear leak onto a temple.
Why am I crying?
Embarrassed, he rolled his face away.
Yes, our little fisherwoman's quite resourceful,
the old man said. And then Chris felt the slight pressure of a thumb wiping away the wet on his face.
It is not weakness to become emotional after a shock. You're clearly a very strong boy, Christopher.
But how can I still be alive?
Chris whispered. He opened his eyes.
You said I was dead. I felt myself die.
I know what I said. You were given poison that should have killed you, but didn't. You should be dead, but you're not.
The old man laid a gentle hand on Chris's cheek, a touch for which Chris was almost absurdly grateful.
I can't explain it.
Maybe it wasn't as bad as Hannah thought.
He could feel the tears dribbling into his hair.
She shouldn't have done that. I'm not a horse with a broken leg.
Fair enough. But would you have drunk poison willingly? Would you have had faith in a girl you'd never met, that she was right? You were going to die, and this was more merciful?
Well, she was wrong, wasn't she?
She may have been mistaken about the extent of your injuries. Hannah's quite skillful. She'll be a fine healer some day. But no, she's not a doctor.
Are you?
No, but I've been a healer for a very long time, and I know that tiger trap.
How did they...
He heard himself hyperventilating, but couldn't stop it.
He couldn't get the trap off. It hurt too much. I heard them argue. Hannah was worried I would bleed even more.
That's right.
The old man's tone was dry, factual.
After you slipped away, they turned you over and pulled you off.
I believe they cut a spike or two to do it. Cut me off. The image of them flipping the door and his limp body tacked on iron spikes like a frog pinned to a dissecting pad stroked the small hairs along his neck. They would have bundled him up, too, before throwing his wrapped corpse onto a horse, or had the horse drag me if it got spooked. He supposed he was lucky they hadn't decided to bury him under rocks. "Nathan was hit with a mace," he said. "That big log, I heard his neck break. Did he come back from the dead, too?"
"No. His body's still in the death house."
Still, he could feel the scream trying to squeeze past his teeth. "That's where I was. They thought I was dead. They put me with Nathan. Then how?"
"We'll bury him come spring, if you'd like. We don't cremate remains, although we did butcher his horse for our dogs. We also have Nathan's belongings. Clothing, rifle, a radio. I suppose they're yours now."
The old man paused.
"I know you don't agree, Christopher, but I've had ample time to examine you. From the extent of your injuries and visible wounds, well, what's left of them, Hannah did the right thing."
Left of them? Every time this old man opened his mouth, Chris felt his mind scrambling to keep up. "What do you mean, what's left of them?" In reply, the old man reached and peeled the sheet from Chris's chest down to his waist.
"You've half a dozen wounds, three of which are quite serious. This one..."
The old man lay a dry palm over Chris's right side, just below his ribs.
"Was the worst. A through and through that collapsed your lung, your difficulty breathing. Hannah said you had tracheal deviation."
He touched a finger to his own knobby Adam's apple.
"Your windpipe had shifted to one side. That happens when air collects inside your ribcage instead of the lung. And do you remember the pain in your belly? That was probably from blood pooling in your abdomen. But look now."
Chris craned to peer down at his stomach. A pink eye of taut, raw-looking scar tissue, about as big around as a half dollar, stared up from his abdomen just below the shelf of his ribs.
"My God!"
He heard his sudden intake of breath. The first time around, when he came to, he remembered the old man's hand on his stomach.
"How can this be?"
"You have a matching exit wound to the right of your spine. From its location, I suspect you sustained a laceration of your kidney as well. Yet that, too, is almost healed. Here."
Chris felt a tug at his left wrist as the old man worked the knot.
"As long as you promise not to choke me again, let me... There. Look at your hand, Christopher."
At first, he thought there was nothing. But then his eyes picked out the half-moon of the mostly healed slash, running from the web between his thumb and first finger down to his wrist. He stared dumbfounded.
"A spike did that,"
the old man said, although his words were faint, nearly lost in the sudden buzz that filled Chris's ears.
"As you can see, the thumb was nearly severed, but here you are, almost healed. All your wounds are in much the same condition."
"But how?" He turned his hand over, then made a fist. It didn't hurt at all.
"That's not possible. How can this be happening? Why am I still alive?"
"Can't say."
The old man threw up his hands.
"Is it the tonic, or a mistake, as you say? A combination of both the tonic and your physiology? Or is this only a miracle or magic?"
"There's no such thing as magic,"
Chris managed through numb lips. He recalled the dark guttural mutters, the strange incense that filled his nose,
and his hands on my chest. I remember how I felt something leaving.
A bolt of fresh fear burned a path through his chest.
"I don't believe in miracles."
"I don't either. Although you could argue that an 8-year-old slip of a girl finding the strength to hoist a 17-year-old boy onto a horse to be a touch miraculous. That is, until you consider that the human body reacts to emergencies by flooding the tissues with adrenaline. This increases blood flow, gives more energy, greater strength. So Ellie was frightened, it was an emergency, and her body reacted. She even gave up her coat for you, and should have been really cold. But she never felt it, because the same physiological mechanism also kept her warm. So, see?
The old man spread his hands in a no-tricks-up-my-sleeve gesture.
No miracles, just science. But that's not what you were doing when I woke up. That wasn't science. No, that was faith, like the Grudifus.
The old man stroked a finger over a wooden charm hung around Chris's chest on a leather cord.
Ellie believed it would protect you. Whether it did is immaterial. It was something she could give, and in return, that gave her courage. It gave her faith. But all emotions are chemically mediated, and may be manipulated. Every drunk, every lover, any ecstatic mystic knows that. There is no heart.
The old man palmed his own chest, then touched a temple.
Without the head.
So what were you doing then?
I was calling on God to heal you,
the old man said simply.
I was also suggesting to you that it might be time to wake up. And you did, rather spectacularly. And don't bother objecting. I'm sure it was coincidence and no miracle. There is only what we don't understand. Oh, of course, this.
He touched Chris's stomach.
I don't understand at all.
I don't understand any of this, Chris said.
Do you remember it at all? Because we think you were dreaming, and for quite a while, too. Days.
The old man traced a circle in the air before his own eyes.
They were moving, as they might in intense REM sleep.
His tongue tangled.
Dreams. All those dreams. They felt so real.
I only remember a little. Right before...
Yes,
the old man prompted.
Did you see something, Christopher?
The nightmares were in pieces, daggers of glass from badly smashed mirrors, and he thought now just as dangerous.
I saw Lena and Peter and my father.
He felt his heart suddenly sprinting in his chest.
Lena!
God, in all that had happened, he'd forgotten about her. She'd been with him. Where could she have gone? And didn't she know Jaden?
Yes, she said she was in a group of 10 kids with Jaden. So that means I found a group. Her group. Christopher? I don't want to talk about it,
Chris said, hoping he didn't sound as frightened as he suddenly was. If Lena wasn't dead, where was she? Could she have headed back to Rule?
But Lena's no good in the woods, not alone, and she was sick, pregnant.
She'd said that Peter was the father, so that must be why he'd linked the two of them together in his nightmares. Her going back to Rule made no sense either, especially since Jaden was here. So what had happened? Had she simply freaked out and run into the woods and become lost? She'd never survive that.
Could the change have gotten to her? But then why didn't they kill me?
Maybe it was as simple as they couldn't get at him. Lena was easy pickings,
yet that made no sense.
The changed wouldn't have cared if he was alive, barely alive, or dead. Meat was meat. By rights, he ought to be in pieces or bare bones. Regardless, saying anything about Lena now would be a mistake. His mind went through the same mental calculus as it had with Ellie and Alex. Telling about Alex wouldn't have helped the little girl, and might make things 10 times worse for him.
He was at a disadvantage here, and effectively a prisoner. These people were not his friends.
Hannah had only proved he couldn't trust them.
So keep your mouth shut. They've already tried to kill you once. Say nothing. It was a pretty bad dream, he said. That's all I remember.
I see.
That dark gaze was clear and very direct, and Chris had the uncomfortable feeling that this old man read exactly what was behind his eyes.
Was it the only one? I don't know,
he said, resisting the urge to sneak his gaze elsewhere.
You sounded very frightened.
I was scared. This was true. I couldn't move. The dream felt very real.
Ah,
the old man nodded.
Probably a hypnagogic hallucination. They can be quite frightening, because your body is still in the grip of a sleep paralysis. It's the brain's way of protecting you from yourself. Otherwise, we'd all act out our worst nightmares. Given how long you've been in REM sleep, how active your brain's obviously been, I'm not surprised. Could it be a side effect of the poison? I mean, another one, other than not ending up dead?
Perhaps. The old man showed a thin smile.
Intense dreams were commonly reported. That was the point of ingesting the mushroom to begin with. This particular genus is loaded with psychedelics, toxins, and other interesting compounds. Mushroom? Amanita pseudomori. The false death mushroom. Apt. It and a cousin, the fly agaric, have a long and colorful history. You can read about it if you wish. In any event, Jaden, quite a bright boy, a real scientist, he thinks the decoction induced a bizarre sleep coma. That, combined with the cold, put you in a hibernative state, slowed down your metabolic processes, somehow protected your brain. It's a decent theory. We know that coma is sometimes protective for brain-injured patients, children who've drowned in cold water. My brain wasn't injured. I didn't drown. I bled out. I couldn't breathe. And what explains the scars? No, you didn't. You're quite unique, Christopher, beyond the fact that you're still you. You mean that I haven't changed? That's our name for it, your brother's. He's my... His throat moved in another dry swallow. My grandfather. Reverend Jaeger... Ah, yes. I've been told that my brother and I have the same eyes.
Isaac Hunter's were, however, still kind.
I suppose this makes you my great-nephew. I guess.
He didn't have a clue.
I was sent to find you. I assumed as much.
Was it Jessica?
In a way. Jess, with black mirrors for eyes in the land of the dead, and Peter was there too, and Lena...
He was suddenly exhausted, the events of everything that had happened finally catching up.
It's kind of a long story,
and so pointless now. Nathan was dead. Given his dream, he bet Lena was too.
What am I thinking? I don't believe in magic or dreams.
And yet he'd pulled, what, a Lazarus? That was crazy. He'd accept a weird coma before coming back from the land of the dead.
I don't understand what there is for me to find here, or why you're so important,
he said.
Jaeger's my grandfather. That's not news. So fine, you're his brother, and you're either Amish or lead some breakaway sect, but so what?
Well, I agree, Hunter said, if that were the only story or all there was to discover.
What more is there?
That depends.
On what?
On how much you know about Simon Jaeger, Hunter said, and Penny Ernst.
Chapter 57. Somewhere west of Rule, and 4 days after the ants, 2 weeks after the avalanche, Wolf led them down a single, unmarked, dead-end rut along an isolated and very large lake nestled in the cup of broad, rolling, forested moraines. From the lack of houses ringing the shore and that rut, Alex thought the lake might be privately owned, a secret getaway. About 2 miles in, she spotted a boathouse and lone stake dock with a single slip perched on the water's edge down a steep hill to her right. On a high hill to her left and directly across from the lake was a rough-hewn 2-story house with a large chalet-style picture window on the left and a partially completed wraparound porch, still on bricks and cinder block, running off the front door and curling around to the right. The house was surrounded on 3 sides by tall stands of densely packed evergreens and hardwood, and the dusky, flayed and gutted carcasses of 4 wolves dangling like totems. All the blood drained from her head. The last time she'd seen anything like this was just outside the zone, guarding the way to Wolf's feeding grounds and that arena with its grisly pyramids of decaying human skulls. purple tongue jutting in a stiff apostrophe, one wolf dangled from a thick iron hook punched through its chest. The body hung to the right of the front door, where you might put a cheery flowered banner, "Welcome, friends." To the extreme left, a second wolf, its eyeless sockets wide with eternal wonder, was suspended 30 feet up a weathered spruce. Alongside, a very large navy blue Cordura stuff sack hung from a carabiner clipped to a red paraline tied off around the trunk of a smaller adjacent tree. A bear bag. She watched as the fingers of a light westerly breeze snatched the naked wolf and gave it a playful twirl. The paraline let out a soft squee. Her lips were numbing, as was her brain. From the aroma of chilled people steak, she understood that the sack was where the changed stored their kills. The idea that she'd come all this way only to be hacked up for storage in the equivalent of a deep freeze. Her throat began to clench, and she'd clapped both hands to her mouth, unsure if she would vomit or scream or both. The front door opened then. A second later, a bull-necked boy lumbered out, trailed by another changed, honey-blonde, blue-eyed. The shock of recognition was physical, a splash of icy water. The hair wreathing the girl's haggard features was what Alex recalled from a picture in yet another lake house. The square jaw, the nose were right. Willowy before, the girl was much thinner now. Well, mostly thin. Alex wasn't really certain until the girl turned, and Alex saw her in profile. Then everything clicked into place. That green medics pack, the lengths to which Wolf had gone to save and protect her, his scent of lilacs and honeysuckle, safe and family. Regardless of how he might feel about her, she now understood why Wolf needed her, too. She finally got what was going on. Penny Ernst, Peter's sister, was pregnant. Chapter 58. Correspond with images of the naked, red-eyed, wild man god known in Vedic mythology as the Red Howler, the raw-eyed beast or Red Storm. As father of the Hindu storm gods, Rudra was clearly linked to intoxication. With his mad eyes and golden hair, this is a white-skinned god, the divine link to the land of the dead, which doesn't prove anything other than people have been getting high for thousands of years, he muttered, eyeing the stack of books Isaac had carted up. The Ethnobotanical Encyclopedia of Psychoactive Plants, Medicinal Plants of the Great Lakes Region, Little Deaths, The Physiology of Coma and Trance States. Not light reading, but they'd kept him isolated in this bedroom for the last 2 days, and Chris had plenty of time on his hands. Anything was better than stewing over what Isaac had said about Penny Ernst and Peter, Simon, his grandfather, and Jess. Tempting as it may be to regard Rudra as the physical manifestation of the fly agaric mushroom, I believe there to be a much better candidate for this lost, mysterious, and mystical drink. Close study of Vedic poetry, with its frequent mentions of regenerative death sleeps, resurrection, and divine visions, point to the much rarer and more lethal cousin, A. Pseudomori. Death sleeps clearly suggest comas of varying durations, during which time's metabolic demands. From across the room came a timid knock.
Chris?
Come on in. Oh, sorry, I forgot. It's locked. Yes, it was perverse and a little nasty, but he was starting to go batshit stir-crazy. There were only so many sit-ups and push-ups a guy could do. Any longer in solitary, and he'd be as beefy as an inmate. Now the fact that he was feeling so strong after both weeks on the trail and some time in cold storage, he didn't want to think about that. An uncertain pause on the other side of the door.
"Do you want me to go away?"
Don't be a creep. It's not her fault. Other than Isaac, the rest were hanging back, spending as little time with him as possible. As pissed as he wasn't sure he blamed them. No, he said, and shoved back from the table. Come on in, Ellie. There was the thunk of a lock being thrown.
The door cracked a few inches, revealing the worried eyes of that morning's guard, a strawberry blonde named Eli, and then a flash of golden braids as Ellie pushed past. Ellie! Eli made a grab that Ellie easily dodged. Jayden said we should wait for the dogs.
Mina knows he's okay.
Ellie gave her dog an affectionate ruffle.
Don't you, girl?
Relax, Eli. I'm still talking, Chris said as Mina trotted over, gave Chris's hand a welcoming snuffle, then immediately flopped on her back, tail thumping.
Grinning, Chris obliged with a furious belly scratch that set the dog to squirming.
You like that, girl? You like it?
He said as the dog's back legs pedaled.
That's a good girl.
She's such a baby.
Dropping to her knees, Ellie brushed aside a corn-tassel curl that had escaped her left braid to coil at her temple.
Like I never pay attention to her.
It's okay,
Chris said as Mina stretched both front legs and let out a blissful moan.
I like it. My dog did this all the time.
You miss him?
Yep. Jet's a good dog. I bet you'd like him.
Chris gave Mina's belly a firm clap, then looked up at the little girl.
Going fishing?
She's always going fishing, Eli put in. Ellie showed Chris an exaggerated eye roll.
I was wondering if, maybe in a couple days, if they let you out, you want to come with me?
Sure, he said, then couldn't resist the dig. But I guess it all depends on whether Isaac and Hannah think I'm going to eat you. God, Eli's face darkened. Don't be such a jerk. The hopeful shine on Ellie's face dimmed.
They don't think that, Chris. You know they have to be sure.
Yeah, yeah. Don't be such a turd. Sorry, I'm not usually an ass... such a creep.
It's all right, you're just upset.
But her smile was more tentative than before.
No excuse.
Reaching across the dog, he tucked that corkscrew curl behind her ear and let his hand linger a moment, enjoying the flush of delighted surprise that spread over her face. Cute kid, but he could see the sadness in the slightly dusky hollows under her eyes.
The least I can do is be nice to the girl who saved my life. And don't start,
he held up a finger.
It is so a big deal.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Ellie looked pleased enough to burst.
Now that you're feeling better, is it okay if I ask you a question?
Of course.
He said it easily enough, but he felt his stomach suddenly knot with apprehension.
Shoot.
Before I came here, I had these friends.
Ellie nibbled at her lower lip.
Alex and Tom. Not my age, but older, like you. Actually, I think Tom was even older. He was a soldier like my dad, only Tom was in Afghanistan, not Iraq, and worked on bombs and stuff. Anyway, we were all together. They took care of me, but then we got separated when Tom...
Her eyes shimmered and her mouth twisted exactly the way a little girl's would if she was trying hard not to cry.
When these adults took me, Tom got shot and...
He listened with growing dismay as she narrated a story he'd heard once before. Ever since that morning on the snow, when he'd swum back in such pain and fear to put two and two together, he knew this moment would come. Until this second, he wondered what he would do, and why that should be a question.
This kid risked her neck for you. The least you can do is man up.
So, what I was wondering...
Ellie dropped her gaze to her hands, as if afraid of finding the answer in his face.
Was if Tom and Alex... if they got to rule?
A tear broke against her fingers. Eyes still averted, Ellie knuckled her cheek.
Are they there? Are they okay?
He was going to hate himself forever.
I'm sorry, Ellie,
he said,
but I never met them. You were such an asshole.
Through the windows, Chris watched as Isaac put a hand on the little girl's head. That loosened something, because Ellie suddenly flung her arms around the old man's waist and buried her face. Even two stories up and across a half acre, Chris could see the little girl's shoulders shudder.
She's the only one who cares, and you go and lie. Yeah, well, you get fed poison, cut off from a bunch of spikes and left for dead. See how you feel.
The self-disgust on his tongue was so thick a bottle of mouthwash wouldn't cover the taste.
You think she's going to like you so much when she finds out that you got Alex killed? That you decided it was easier to pretend there was nothing the slightest bit weird going on with the Zone? He wouldn't be surprised if Ellie wanted dibs on the firing squad, and no, he was not overreacting. These kids put down people. What bothered him, too, was how quickly the lies came. He thought he was past all that, the night of the hammer and his father and the strange, meaty thunks and Deidre's screams. 10 years later, and he still remembered answering that detective's questions.
"No, sir, I didn't hear anything. No, I was asleep. Hammer? No, sir, I haven't seen a hammer anywhere. I don't think we even have one."
"No, detective, I love my dad." He leaned his forehead against chilled glass. Just below the sill were stark coils of some very thick but snow-covered vine winding up a high iron trellis. "I'm only 8, and I've just listened to my dad kill someone, and no, sir, he never hurts me." Despite the bright sun of early afternoon, the double-paned windows fogged with his breath. Through the patchy haze, he watched Ellie boost herself onto the saddle of a dingy brown mare. The way to the lake wound through thick woods, fringing a vast bowl of glittering snow that, from the wire and steel posts, must be the farmstead's garden plot. Chris saw the old man raise a hand as Ellie, Eli, and their dogs disappeared, and then gather the reins of a dun-colored saddlebred, which he led toward a weathered, dark-gray stable just off the long, frozen oval of a duck pond south of the house. Switching to the south-facing window, Chris tracked Isaac's progress as the shadows of the man and his horse, long and spider-thin, dashed away toward distant, wooded countryside. Nestled a short distance to the right of the stable, a clutch of cows had gathered in a white corral around a feed station outside a red, high-pitched gable barn with a stone foundation. Like the stable, the barn was decorated with several hex signs, half-stars in fake arches over the windows that Hannah had called devil's doors, as well as white rosettes. With its east-to-west orientation, Chris could just make out a swirling blue-and-gold wheel of fortune beneath the peak at the gable end. As he neared the barn, Isaac waved to another boy, not tall enough to be Jaden, so maybe Connor or Rob, pushing a barrow of soiled hay.
"Man, I would muck stables 24/7 if they'd just let me out of here."
Sighing, Chris closed his eyes. He wasn't stupid, so why was he acting that way? Forget how this would hurt Ellie in the long run. What about the fact that he was only digging himself in deeper with lies? Once the truth got out, and it would, they'd find it that much harder to trust him. "Yeah, but look how long everyone's been lying to me." The story was so incredible, he doubted anyone could make it up. As much as he didn't want to believe it, what Isaac said answered a lot of questions. It even explained Peter's reaction when Chris showed up in Rule. One look at Chris, and Peter probably stalked into the council to demand an explanation. What would Jaeger have admitted?
"Betcha not much," Chris said. "You really think an old asshole like that is going to fess up to getting his business partner's wife pregnant?
Or that Chris's grandmother was Jess?" All Isaac knew was that when Jaeger and Jess's daughter, Chris's mom, showed up with twin baby boys, Jaeger agreed to take only one, who turned out to be Simon. Chris was sent back to his dad, who probably raised a huge stink or got some money out of it. Not that his father spent a dime more on Chris than he had to. This was a man who never had two nickels to rub together, who always kept the money Chris made from summer lawn-mowing jobs for safekeeping, was what his dad always said, for college. Right. When you boozed as much as his dad, you needed all the pocket change you could scrape together. But how had Jaeger decided something like that? Put him and Simon side by side and done eeny, meeny, miny, mo, drawn straws? Chris could count the number of times he'd actually spent more than 5 minutes with Jaeger on one hand, but he now understood why all his meetings with Jaeger only happened once a year, and always in restaurants in other towns outside of Merton, and nowhere close to Rule. No way Jaeger would risk anyone seeing him and asking Chris, "Hey, Simon, how's it hanging, kid? or risk him and Simon laying eyes on each other.
No wonder Dad always got roaring drunk afterward. Every time he saw Jaeger was just one more reminder of how he'd ended up stuck with...
The knock was perfunctory, a warning more than a request. He heard a jingle of keys, the rattle of the knob, and then Hannah was hip-butting in on an aroma of stewed carrots, boiled potatoes, and rich sauce. A handgun rode just below her right hip.
"Lunch. Better late than never," she said by way of greeting. "Got tied up with the lambing. Still have 4 ewes waiting to deliver."
"What? No Jaden to make sure I don't jump you?" he said.
"He and Connor are out hunting and checking trap lines. They won't be back until they have something. Jaden always pushes the envelope."
"At least he gets to do something. I could help out around here, you know."
"No, that won't be necessary."
Butting the door closed, she walked to the table where he'd laid his books.
"Do you mind?"
Although the smell was driving him crazy, he didn't move a muscle.
"You aren't worried I've got a sudden hankering for a chicken wing instead of beef stew?"
"No, you're still talking. It's venison, and I don't insult easily."
Her gray gaze was unflinching.
"I'm also much faster, younger, and quite possibly a better shot than Isaac. Now, are you going to help, or would you like me to leave this on the floor?"
Wordlessly, he swept the books into an untidy heap and dumped them on the bed. Leaning against a brass bedpost, he crossed his arms and watched her lay out his food with efficient, economical movements. It bothered him that he noticed how neatly that buckwheat mane wove into a smooth braid, or that she still smelled like honey and oatmeal.
"Besides the stew," she said, showing him her back, "there are some peaches put up last year, and I brewed you a cup of nettle tea. It's high in iron and good for correcting any anemia."
"Yeah? Maybe I should have a taster first."
When she turned, she did it without a lot of drama, the way a kindergarten teacher understands that screaming at the annoying little kid will only make him tantrum harder.
"I've already apologized. I know I'm not perfect, but given the circumstances..."
"Yes, blah, blah, blah. If you had to do it over again, you'd still make the same choice. I know. Like you said, we've been over this."
"Then what do you want from me?"
"Someone to argue with, so I don't have to think about what to do next.
How about letting me out of here, for starters?"
"You know that's not my decision."
"But Isaac would listen to you."
"Probably, but I don't think this is a bad call either. While I've not seen that many kids turn, what happened to you is very different."
"Like you said, I'm still talking. I came back as me."
From where was a question he didn't want to think about and couldn't answer anyway. He made a sweeping gesture at the books.
"You're the college kid. There's the science. What more do you want?"
"My advice is still the same. Take this up with Isaac."
"Now, if that's all," she began to move toward the door, "I have chores that need doing and lambs that need feeding."
"Wait."
As angry as he was, he needed a break from himself.
"Look, I'm sorry I'm being a jerk. I guess I'm not used to getting killed and then waking."
"Sorry." He held up a hand.
"Sorry. That was the wrong thing to say. Can you stay for a little while? No one but Isaac and Ellie talk to me. You treat me like I'm some kind of leper. I can't decide if Jaden wants to dissect me or run experiments to figure out what makes me tick."
"If he had access to a lab, he'd probably do both,"
Hannah said, though she didn't smile. That did not make him feel better.
"Why are you guys so afraid of me?"
"You need to ask that? We can't explain you. We don't know what will happen. And, oh, you've been just a little violent."
"I was confused, okay? You try getting crushed, poisoned, and then woken up with some old guy doing a bunch of mumbo-jumbo on you and see if you're not just a little freaked out."
"Has it ever crossed your mind that I am, Chris? I'm not exactly thrilled to have misread the situation."
She sounded angry now.
Misread the situation?
Had she just admitted to making a mistake?
"So can we agree that we're all a little on edge? Please stay a while. I hate being alone all the time. All I've got is what's running around in my head. 5 minutes. If I'm a jerk again, you can leave."
"I don't need your permission," she said,
although he thought there might be the ghost of a smile this time.
What do you want to talk about?
Now that she was staying, everything seemed to jam behind his teeth.
You thought I was Simon? How well did you know him? Did you know Peter? Tell me more about Penny.
But all that felt too personal, too fast.
Do you want to sit?
Thanks. Slipping into a straight back, she clutched the tray to her chest like a shield.
So, what's on your mind?
Okay, here's what I don't understand. Actually, there were quite a few things he didn't get, but he decided to start with something that was not only safe, but pointed out that really he could be trusted.
Oh, right.
His inner voice needled. That so explains why you lied to Ellie and haven't told them about Lena.
You know I'm the one who's been taking your sickest kids back to Rule. I'm the one who's left food and supplies.
Yes, and you can leave kibbles out for a stray cat, she said with that same neutral tone. But that doesn't mean you won't skin it for stew the minute it gets close.
But all I did was show up at that bookmobile. I never knew you guys were there until you left that first little girl for me to find.
This was only a small lie. He'd made it his business to visit Orin after Jess pointed him that way. Why she never said she'd broken from the Amish herself or mentioned Boo about Isaac was something only Jess could answer.
Actually, no. That was another group's decision. I had no part in that, and I wouldn't have agreed if I'd been asked.
That's pretty harsh.
Is that a question or an observation?
Both. Don't you guys have rules or something? Doesn't Isaac tell you what to do?
Of course not. He's an advisor.
So you guys run things yourself?
More or less. We're free to disagree, but there's a certain consensus from group to group.
Yeah, like the one about putting down kids you don't think will make it.
Yet even that must not be an absolute. He'd rescued several very sick kids, some of whom had died once back in Rule.
Isaac's the only adult?
The only one left. He keeps tabs on us, moves from group to group.
How many groups are there?
Is that important?
Okay, so they weren't going there. Fine, you're right. Not important.
Not entirely. Peter had talked about carrying capacities, how alarmingly fast Rule had grown beyond its resources.
So what about my original question? You guys made the first move, not me.
Which was not entirely true. After Jess mentioned there might be kids around the old Amish settlement, he made it his mission to rescue as many as possible. He'd visited frequently, aware of the eyes on his back, careful to always leave some token supplies, batteries, food, at the old bookmobile where he'd found that first spared, a very sick girl, just inside the front door. She was also the only child he hadn't had to jump through hoops to find.
Discovering that girl wasn't a fluke, he said. Those kids made sure I found her. After her, they left a note to clue me in on the hex signs. They obviously didn't think I was a threat.
And as I said, it wasn't my call. Look, we could go round and round about this for days, so let me ask you something, Chris.
She leaned forward.
If there had been other children who weren't sick, say you stumbled on us, would you have taken us back to Rule? By force?
Probably.
He could feel the heat splash his cheeks.
Yes.
Then that makes you no better than the people who stole Ellie.
It's not so black and white.
Yes, it is. I never stole a child. I've never allowed anyone to use a child as a way to buy sanctuary.
As you might say, that wasn't my call.
But you enforced it.
We've all had to make choices. All I ever wanted was to help. I did what I thought was right at the time.
Coming out of his mouth, they sounded like the platitudes they were.
And you'd still do it all over again.
You mean like you deciding to kill me?
He shot back.
Yeah, I guess I would. So we're even. I'd try to find ways to keep kids alive, and you'd trick people into taking poison.
He could hear the echo of his shout in the sudden silence. She was rigid, the skin around her mouth tight, her cheeks high with wild color.
Idiot. He had to stay calm, be reasonable,
push people too far and they exploded.
Sorry, Dad. Sorry, it's my fault. I won't do it again.
I never...
She cleared her throat.
It's never a trick. When someone is beyond help, when there is no hope, it's a choice. When we know for certain, when the dogs warn us that a child is... Her gray eyes shuttled away. Turning, it's still a choice. A choice between what and what. What do you think, Chris? If you were turning, if you knew that you'd try to kill your friends, people you loved, are you telling me that you'd choose to become one of them? Between what and what? He asked again. At that moment, he understood completely why Peter set up the zone. Despite the secrets and lies, he knew Peter still loved him, would die for him. If Peter had confided in him, would he have helped?
Maybe I would. Because if Alex changed, if Peter did, I could never pull the trigger.
He bet Peter would have felt no differently. Watching his friends and people he loved change in front of his eyes, Peter would have tried to find a way. Where there was life, there was hope. They might change back, get better. The trick was keeping them alive long enough to give them that chance.
Yes, but how long would you run the experiment? Months? Years? Does hope have a termination date? Don't tell me you'd let any kid you think is changing wander around. So what's the choice?
He realized that he really was spoiling for a fight, some way of hitting back.
What do you do? Lock them up and starve them to death, or only shoot them when they go rabid? Don't you judge us!
Her gray eyes went flinty.
Don't you dare! I don't owe you answers, Chris. You think you're so superior, so right? You know nothing about us. You don't know me either. You're not even interested in my point of view. You've already judged me.
His voice was shaky. The low simmer in his gut was near to a boil.
So fine. Let's do a little math, Hannah, because math is clean. It's pristine. It's so scientific that Jaden would approve. You can't massage numbers. There's no arguing with 2 + 2. This is pointless. He rode over her. Not counting me and Nathan, there are 11 bodies in that death house. Assuming your group started with 20 people, give or take, that means you've lost 70% of your original population in 5 months. Some of those people were old, but the majority weren't, isn't that right? Some kids changed after, and either you killed them before they could change all the way, or once they had. But there were others, Hannah, others who were sick and you couldn't help. So they died. You can't always cheat death, Chris. Yeah, but there's a time for everything, even death.
Then he thought, get out of my head, Jess. Aloud, he said,
let's exclude the kids who changed, okay? What about the others, the ones who were just plain sick? Why not accept help? Hannah, do the math. At this rate, by the end of the year, there won't be any of you left. Is that why you came, Chris?
Her voice was cold. To convince us to go back with you?
Maybe. In the beginning.
What about now?
Beats me. He threw up his hands. I don't know. I think there's a better way than simply giving up and accepting, all right?
You want to fight.
Of course I want to fight. Life may not be great, but it beats dying. I just don't know how to change things in rule, or if I even can.
Is that where you want to go? Back to rule?
I don't know.
If his grandfather had anything to say about it, he'd be dead or in the prison house before he had a chance to do anything.
This whole thing about Isaac, it was a setup. I was supposed to find out about Jess and Simon and Jaeger. I was supposed to figure out about the zone and Peter. I see it's wrong, but I also understand.
You understand?
Yes, I really do see both sides. He said, and thought, Chris on the right, Chris on the left, eeny meeny. Not everything about rule is bad. Like, take Ellie. You seriously believe an 8-year-old girl isn't better off someplace where she can be protected? Or that she even has the ability to make that choice? What if she was 7 or 4? How young is too young to know better?
You've got a point?
Yes. You have a cutoff where it's no longer a kid's choice. But how did you get there, Hannah? What makes you think you're right?
Hannah threw up her hands. Fine, we'll never agree. You are so like Peter, wanting to reduce all of life and death to cutoffs and percentages, when to step in, when not to.
Of all the things she could have said, this wasn't it. Wait a minute, he said as she stood. What do you mean? How well did you know Peter?
Well enough, she was already turning away. I really don't want to talk about this right now, Chris.
But what if I do? What if I need to, Hannah?
He had to snatch back the impulse to grab her wrist.
Please, please don't go. Please, what are you talking about?
He saw the warring emotions chase over her face, and the moment she made her decision.
I'm talking about the accident, she said.
Accident? He said. What accident?
You're not going to like it, Chris. You think you've found out all there is to discover about Peter? About Simon?
She showed a brittle smile.
Believe me, those waters run deep.
What accident? He said again.
The accident 2 years ago, she said, when Penny killed a girl.
Chapter 59.
Wait, just hold on.
Gulping air, Alex eyed a splashy tangle of guts and one tiny paw with its broken nib of bone. Squashed Bunny didn't bother her. What ticked her off was that in the last 2 days since arriving at the lake house, this was the only rabbit she'd snared. As the trammeled and bloody snow wavered, Alex propped her hands on her thighs and hung her head, praying both that the dizziness would pass, and Darth, the nickname she'd given to her guard, wouldn't feel inspired to use the butt of his rifle or a fist. A chronic mouth breather, Darth was the kind of sinus-challenged kid with adenoids the size of baseballs that always had the seat behind yours for a major test. If anyone ever felt the need to make another Star Wars, though... When Wolf wasn't around, Darth enjoyed the random punch, a swift swat. She even understood. She got grumpy, too, when she was starving. Except Darth had the Mossberg.
Just give me a minute, Darth, she said. Okay?
While this was only her second day at the lake house, she was fast coming to know Darth's scents and moods. From his impatient fizz, she knew it wasn't okay at all, but screw it. The kid was a brute and as noisy as a locomotive. She wouldn't put it past Darth to let her faint and then either quietly slide back into the house until she froze or put a boot on her throat. By the time Wolf got back from his hunting expedition with Ernie and Marley, she'd be bones. Gee, boss, I don't know, she was just here. After the fiasco in the cabin, she doubted Wolf would have left her alone if there hadn't been enough in that bear bag to tide over the natives until his return. But she was finding it very tough to relax while Darth toyed with guess who's coming to dinner.
Just when I thought things might finally break my way.
That coil of wire she'd discovered in a cardboard box with other camping paraphernalia 4 days ago was the first piece of good luck she'd had. With Darth tagging after, she'd tramped far back into the woods and around the house, scoping out game trails. Plenty of tracks, lots of juicy little bunnies running around, lay out 16 snares and pray like hell. Well, she studied the mess in the snow. She'd caught something, all right. Only to have the rabbit snatched by an animal just as hungry as she.
Got to be whatever's following us.
Probably a wolf, too. Those tracks were right. So was the smell. Although there was still that queer something that was a little off and...
Oh, screw it. Wolf, not wolf. Who cares?
She smeared an angry tear from the corner of her right eye. Crying wouldn't help either. Only thing to do was move the snare to a different game trail and start over.
And look on the bright side, Alex.
Here you were, so worried about what to use for fish bait. Mounding the half-frozen guts into a rough snow bowl, she gave the mess a grim stir with her forefinger and fished out a small, roughly triangular squib of flesh.
Oh, and what do we have here?
Darth, want to see another trick my dad taught me?
Popping the rabbit's heart into her mouth, she swallowed it back and licked her lips.
Yum, yum, Alex said. Delish.
Maybe an hour later, she eyed Ellie's watch. Habit. Mickey was still dead, but wearing the watch made her feel better. Whenever now was, it was as good a time as any to search the boathouse before all those great bunny guts went to waste. The day was brilliant, the snow dazzle bright enough to scorch purple afterimages, the sun a gold coin that made her shadow puddle at her feet. She shut her eyes against the glare, tried to imagine her cells wringing energy out of sunlight. She had to find something more to eat than bark and twigs and the occasional ant or bunny heart. The boathouse was the only place left where she might find something useful. After scrounging around the main lake house, basement, and garage, she'd come up with some nice stuff. The snare wire, a camp stove, bottles of propane fuel, a Coleman lantern, even a decent one-man tent. The stove seemed like a taunt. The wire she was using for snares was too stiff for fishing, though, unless she decided to start pulling out her hair and braiding it together for fishing line. That left the boathouse. Because lakes had fish, right? Hack through the ice somehow, drop in a line, offer a sacrifice to the gods or something? Earlier, when Alex was stewing up her oh-so-wonderful pot of white pine, she'd happened to glance over at Penny, stretched on a frayed leather couch squared before the great room's picture window. Plenty of light to see by. And damn if Alex hadn't spotted this brief but very distinct little ripple. Not a punch or a kick, more like something rolling over in its sleep. She knew more about quantum physics than she did about pregnancy, and since Alex knew as much about quantum physics as she did Outer Mongolia, she was virtually clueless. None of the very few kids she'd hung with in high school got pregnant or knew anyone who had. All she remembered from those informational drool fests from high school health was that how much you showed and when depended on how tiny you were, and you could feel the baby move on the inside at 4 months, and from the outside at 5 to 6 months, something like that. So Penny's at least 5 months, and maybe more like 6 or 7. Alex had folded a drippy strip of boiled pine into her mouth. The stuff smelled like Christmas and tasted like stale dentine peeled from the underside of a school desk right next door to a booger. Meaning she was pregnant before the zap, which was something to think about. So had Peter brought Penny here before or after things fell apart? Peter had to be involved somehow. Peter and the council set up the zone. Peter was head of security. Peter made sure the changed were fed. Unless Penny was already here before the zap, Alex couldn't see how Peter managed to move her without Penny ripping off his face. Knocked her out somehow? Or what if she knows Peter the way Wolf knows me? Neither scenario accounted for Wolf, who'd been with Spider and the rest of his high school buddies when Alex had bumbled into the zone. Unless she had it the wrong way around. From the lake house photograph at the Jaeger place, she'd seen that Simon and Peter were tight. So maybe Simon knew about this place, and Wolf had wanted to take Penny someplace he thought was safe, a place he could visit every now and then to resupply and check up on her. This begged an obvious question, too. Alex had assumed Wolf was the father. Now she wasn't sure. Oh, Wolf cared about Penny plenty. He was always watching out for her, carrying things that were too heavy, making sure she, and then his guys, ate before he took a single morsel for himself. But Wolf never touched Penny. They didn't snuggle, he didn't hug her, never put a hand on her stomach, although maybe guys only did that in chick flicks, she didn't know. There was nothing intense between Penny and Wolf, no spark. In high school, you always knew who the couples were, no matter how uber-cool and below-the-radar they were about it. Their heat was in their eyes, the glances they shared, the way the air thickened. Like how the very first time she got close to Tom, inhaled his smoky musk, the tug of her attraction had been immediate. When they had kissed, that one moment deepened to something vital, as elemental as air. The only time anything like that happened with Wolf, when his scent shifted and became an aroma that was safety and family and desire, was around her. The only person to whom Wolf seemed truly attached and attracted, and for whom he would risk his life, was her. Which was just so frigging great. The boathouse was an A-framed one-room cabin on stilts, but with no boats or canoes or even kayaks slotted underneath. As soon as she forced the door, she realized she was looking at a man cave, a place where a guy and his buds crashed to get away from the main house. The decor screamed boy, too. Two single beds, one still rumpled, a tiny four-drawer bureau, two straight-back chairs, a bookcase crammed with puzzles, a cribbage board, two decks of cards, board games, and stacks of smeary magazines she knew better than to leaf through. A curling Star Wars poster, Luke battling Vader, thumbtacked over the bookshelf. A ring of keys and an old wind-up alarm clock rested on a plank shelf on the left wall beside the bed, along with road atlases of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan. Several jackets hung from nails just inside the door. Even through the deep cold and Darth's baseline sun-scorched opossum stink plugging her nose, the boathouse had just the right boy smell, too. Sharp deodorant, foot powder, Irish spring. Yet there were two other nose-crinkling odors. One was a campfire odor, or like chemistry class when they'd ignited magnesium. The other was... Her mind flashed to chemo and an oncology nurse feeling for a vein before hooking Alex up to a brown IV bag of cisplatin. Hospital smell. That was it. Alex hauled in more air, worrying the smells, and then forgot all about sulfur and flammable metals, because this time, oh God, her stomach tightened against a whiff of sweet summer. She got a memory pop, a flashbulb moment of her dad. Relax, honey, she's wash and wear. Oh, please, her voice came out squeaky. Her eyes snapped back to the bed, and then she was dropping onto her stomach and batting blankets out of her way, reaching beneath the bed. Oh, please, 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 she chanted, sweeping her glove over bare floorboards, catching woolly dust kittens, a pencil, an old sock, before slapping metal. Scrambling to a cross-legged sit, she dragged out a dented red toolbox. She was shaking so badly she had to use her teeth to tug off her gloves before fumbling open the toolbox's icy chrome latch and throwing back the double lid. Instead of tools, there was a small handful of discarded candy wrappers and, no mistake, the dizzying aroma of chocolate and petrified coconut. Oh! She said it in that breathless, astonished way she did at a gorgeous sunset or a gift too beautiful to be believed. Plunging her hands into the wrappers, she came up with a humongous, giant candy bar that she would have recognized even without the helpful blue and white wrapper and big black letters, Almond Joy King Size. "Sometimes you feel like a nut," she sang. Her grip kept slipping on the slick paper, and she finally ripped the wrapper with her teeth. A luscious perfume of sugar and butter and chocolate ballooned. The butter solids had separated, giving the milky chocolate a dusty, sickly cast. "And ask me if I care," she said. Teasing out a bar, she stuck the candy into her mouth and bit. There was a hollow chuck, a jab of pain in her jaw. The candy was frozen solid and literally rock hard. All she managed was to scrape off a few chocolate shards. Probably best. Closing her eyes, she luxuriated in sweet chocolate melting over her tongue. "Might bring it up if I eat too." A fizz-fizz pop-pop boiled into her nose, and she knew a second before he gave her shoulder a warning nudge, Darth was getting impatient. "Sit on it and spin, Darth." Yet when she reached for her knife, she did it slowly. No reason to give Darth an excuse. Placing the bar on the wood floor, she jockeyed the blade's tip into the chocolate right behind that first almond, then rocked the knife back and forth, applying steady pressure until the bar broke in a small shower of chocolate-covered coconut. "Oh, you don't know what you are missing, Darth. On the other hand, more for me." Wetting a finger, she dabbed up all the shards, then popped the finger into her mouth. "Oh, thank you, God," she moaned. She was definitely taking all the wrappers for later. Give him a nice, long lick. Popping the bit of broken bar into her mouth, she tucked it into her cheek like a chipmunk. The rest she carefully wrapped and then slipped into an inside pocket where her body warmth would thaw out the treat. She was still starving, but even that little bit of chocolate made her blood surge. Yeah, well, don't get giddy, honey. The candy might be the extent of her luck. She didn't see any fishing gear, and her nose hadn't sussed out anything else other than that strange campfire odor and that hospital smell. Where were they coming from? There didn't seem to be much else here but the bureau and another bookshelf, made of sagging 2x4s propped on cinder blocks, filled with hardcovers and paperbacks. A lot of novels, all stuff she'd either read or been meaning to, but never got the chance. Tolkien, Asimov, Bradbury, Matheson. A broken-spined, scotch-taped copy of Childhood's End, Lord of the Flies, Dune. A book she'd read while getting chemo, that mantra about fear as the mind-killer ringing true as she watched the drip-drip of yellow poison flow into her veins. A good collection of Stephen King, too. The Dead Zone, Desperation, and The Stand, Duma Key. A Wrinkle in Time was falling apart, and the spine of Watership Down was so creased she could barely make out the title. But there were also a ton of newer textbooks— Lupine Biology, Mammalian Speciation, The Ecology of Genetic Rescue, Ahead of the Pack, The Wolves of Michigan's Isle Royal, a larger clutch on population genetics and evolution. A third of one shelf was devoted only to history, Where the Buffalo Roam, Roosevelt and the Embattled Wilderness, When Darkness Reigned, Civilizational Collapse in the Middle Ages. "Whoa," she muttered. A voracious reader, who also had been a history buff and hardcore mammalogist, was the last thing she'd expected. On the other hand, Peter was a problem solver, a guy who'd obviously thought about allocation of resources, someone who would have recognized that feeding the changed garnered additional benefits, like a tidy buffer between rule and the rest of the world. Fitting, somehow, that he'd read up on the Dark Ages. She wouldn't mind crashing here a while. Childhood's End looked awfully tempting. So did all that Stephen King. Rereading Wrinkle would be like picking up where you and your best friend left off. Chris would love this, too. A boy who'd dismantle and move an entire bookmobile's collection would want a crack at these. If she got out of this, she ought to bring him here. Don't get ahead of yourself. She had to be practical. You can dream, but food comes first. Searching each jacket, turning out pockets, got her nothing but a crumpled handful of dollar bills liberated from a denim jacket, which she crammed into a parka pocket. Tinder was tinder. She was putting the jacket back when she paused. The garment was big, just as the boathouse had an older boy feel to it. Its aroma was stark wintergreen and icy iron. While in rule, she'd never paid that much attention, but now she inhaled deeply, wondering how scents this bold could hide so much. So, was the house a gift? The chocolate of that almond joy chunk was gone, her tongue pebbly with coconut. Flipping the almond from the pouch of her cheek, she chewed, mulling this over. Her curiosity was stoked, which was somehow better than focusing only on that beaky gnaw in her stomach. Or was this just a really old family vacation house where Peter went when he needed to think things over? That felt right. Yesterday, when she swept the woods to setter's snares, she'd also discovered an ancient weathered treehouse about 30 feet up a towering oak around back. Judging from the lake house's unfinished porch, Peter had been busy. The house had also been recently winterized, with double-paned windows redolent with the reek of putty and caulk. She scented relatively fresh insulation behind the drywall downstairs, the lingering tang of paint. A wood stove, so new the house smelled of scorched cast iron, gave off heat in spades. A lucky thing, too. There were 2 fireplaces, one upstairs and one down, but both were very old, the hearths blackened and cracked. The sting of creosote on her tongue was so strong, she bet you could take a chisel to the coal-black residue caking that flue and still not chip it all away. A wonder no one had started a chimney fire and burned the house down.
He went to college, studied genetics and evolution, history.
So maybe that was the point of the house. Peter had had a whole other life. From the looks of the house, he might have imagined eventually living here year-round. At her back, she heard Darth suddenly hitch as his reek went from fizzy rot to grouchy stink. Despite everything, a grin crept over her lips. She knew what was bugging him. Darth might be an ox, but he had a bladder the size of a walnut. This might explain why Darth got to babysit. A guy who needed a potty break every couple of miles could be a real drag. For her, Darth's frequent need to go wee-wee wasn't a problem, although he had this habit of doing his business, like, practically right on top of her, which not only was TMI, but ticked her off. Want rabbits to stay far away? Pee on the snare, jerk. She was tempted to hurry this up, but then thought, oh, screw it, don't rush this. There's something here, something important. As she stepped up to the bureau, a second flashbulb of memory popped. Of Tom, eyes bright with fever, thighs shiny and taut with infection. But why?
Chemistry lab and Tom. Because I had to sterilize the knife before I cut him.
That was it. That smell like burnt match heads, like flint against a striker. So, were there matches in the drawers? No, the odor was too strong for that.
Gunpowder? Or a gun?
Swallowing against the knot in her throat, she leaned in a little closer, opened her mouth, and tasted the air.
Don't get your hopes up, it's probably not.
But the smell was stronger here, and coming from the bottom drawer of this bureau.
So, if it was a gun, what then?
She couldn't sneak that past Darth.
Unless I shoot him.
But it would have to be loaded, and there'd be no way to check. Might even blow up in my hand if it's old and dirty or the mechanism's frozen. But Darth did need to take a whiz. She slid her eyes in a sidelong glance. The boy was doing the dying-to-pee two-step.
Wear him down. When he goes potty, that'll be your chance.
As slowly as she could, she tugged the top drawer. The wood was swollen and yielded in grudging squalls. From the weight and hollow thock of wood against wood, she could tell it was empty. The second drawer held two pairs of boys' underwear and three pairs of bald socks. As she pushed the second drawer shut, Darth broke, bolting from the boathouse. A moment later, she saw him hustling for the dock.
Well, that's one way to melt a fishing hole.
Wasting not a second more, she dropped to a crouch and pried that bottom drawer free. The balky wood jammed on its metal runner.
Come on, don't blow this.
Risking a fast peek around the bureau, she saw Darth stripping his gloves with his teeth.
Minute and a half max. Squelching her impatience, she wrestled the drawer shut, then slowly pulled straight back.
This time, the drawer cooperated.
Hell, two pairs of jeans, two cargo pants.
While that burnt magnesium scent was still strong, she had no hope of going through each and every pocket before Darth made it back.
Come on!
She slipped a hand beneath the jeans.
Please, God, just cut me a...
She gasped as her fingers curled around smooth metal.
No way, she said. It can't be.
But it was. A pistol. Chapter 60.
Penny killed someone?
Chris felt his jaw drop.
When? Who? Well, more like got her killed. About 2.5 years ago.
With a weary sigh, Hannah dropped back into her chair.
It's a long story.
2.5 years ago, he was a sophomore in high school. Simon would have been 16. Isaac Hunter had said that Penny was a year younger than Simon.
Give me the short version. Did you grow up in Rural, or are you Amish, or was? I left years back.
She shrugged.
I wanted more. School, an education beyond the 8th grade. Peter and I met in Houghton when I was a freshman at Michigan Tech. He was already a senior.
Peter went to college? He blinked in surprise. I always assumed he'd been a deputy since high school or something.
Hardly. He was the TA for my freshman seminar in comparative zoology, managed the lab. Nice guy.
Her mouth moved in an almost wistful grin.
Very forceful, a million opinions. There was this coffee place a block or two up from the river, Siberia Cafe. Peter treated a couple times after lab. We'd grab coffee, hang outside the library along the Kuenaw waterway.
Kuenaw? He had a vague notion that this was way north and east. I'd never been much outside of Merton until I got to Rule.
Oh, the Kuenaw's really beautiful. There's this bridge between Houghton and Hancock, which is a much smaller town on Copper Island right across the waterway. Once you get past Hancock, there's virtually nothing on the island all the way out to Lake Superior, except farms and golf courses, and then Copper Harbor at the very tip. I think about it sometimes. Maybe settling up there?
Her expression turned dreamy.
Raid the university library, then go on past Hancock, find a nice, isolated farm just off Superior, fish, grow crops, read books. That would be all right.
That sounded like something he would enjoy.
Maybe you should make it happen.
Well, I couldn't do it alone, for one thing, and you have to get there, for another. Oh, and hope all the people-eaters have moved out of town.
She gave another wry shrug.
Anyway, Peter really loved school. His big thing was Isle Royal. We'd go back and forth about what they should do about the wolves.
Wolves? Isle Royal?
It was like listening to someone tell him a bedtime story in a foreign language.
Where's that?
In Lake Superior. It's a national park, but hardly anyone goes. It's tough to get there. It's where they were doing this 50-year study on the wolf and moose populations.
They were?
He felt incredibly dense.
Why?
She gave him a look.
Isle Royal's an island, but it's got wolves and moose. So how'd they get there?
Swim?
Only the moose. Wolves can't swim that far. The lead scientists were all in Houghton at Michigan Tech. They figured the wolves came across on ice bridges way back, but because of climate change, there hasn't been a stable bridge since the mid-80s, so the wolves are stuck. Their population's been tanking for the last 10 years. Before the world went dark, there were about 9 wolves left. Only about half were females. So there was a lot of debate about how or whether to save them. Over the summers, Peter did field work, tranquilizing wolves, collecting samples, fitting them with collars, hunting down moose carcasses. He was very passionate, thought it was our fault for wrecking the environment. I think if he could have figured out a way to sneak wolves onto the island, he'd have done it. You have to admire that.
I guess.
Chris felt a nasty pang of envy. If things hadn't fallen apart, that might have been him going to classes and arguing ethics over coffee.
How does all that relate to Penny?
Because of one really bad decision Peter made. The island's all backcountry and very remote. You either go 5 to 7 hours by ferry, fly in on float plane, or pilot your own boat. Peter had this vintage thing he'd refitted with a fiberglass hull. It was like Quint's boat in Jaws. Pilot house, engine room, galley. He turned the forepeak into sleepers. Over spring break of his senior year, he offered to take a bunch of us over to the island. The catch is, the park officially opens in mid-April, and this was mid-March.
You can get into huge trouble if you're caught, but Peter knew a cove to slip into on the north end closer to Canada.
I figured a little winter camping, a little hiking, a nice boat ride, it'd be fun. 12 of us crowded onto this old boat, including Penny.
She paused.
And Simon. He and Peter were close even then. I think the grandparents hoped Simon and Penny would hook up.
That was exactly what Isaac described, too.
They weren't like that?
I never got that vibe. From what Simon said, he always thought he should look after her the way Peter did for him.
Interesting. Just how close had Hannah and Simon been?
How did Penny feel?
Well, she and I never...
She inserted air quotes.
Bonded. She was nearly 15 and still pretty young in a lot of ways. Peter had this real blind spot for her, just adored her.
But she was already very troubled. You could see it the way she hung on some of Peter's college friends. And it was... her gray eyes slid up in a sidelong glance. Spring break. Meaning lots of alcohol. What happened? Everyone got drunk, she said simply. That is, everyone but Simon. Even then, he was a very careful, very private kid. Being a freshman, I didn't know Peter's friends very well, so Simon and I hung, talked about college, his interests, what I was doing. Anyway, there we are in the middle of Lake Superior. No one's wearing a life jacket. It's March and freezing. The water's 40 degrees. Peter's completely wrecked. A beer in one hand or a shot and knocking them back. People are goofing around. A bunch are below, some making out in the bunks, and... she punctuated the sentence with the arch of one eyebrow. Penny, too, with a guy. I think Simon lost track of her. If he'd known, he'd have gotten her out, but I guess he was a little distracted talking to me and keeping an eye on Peter. He still didn't see where this was leading or how Penny got a girl killed. So what happened? Penny set the boat on fire, she said. Chapter 61. This wasn't just any pistol. Alex knew it as soon as she saw that hinged steel barrel and a plastic baggie with a cartridge the size of a 12-gauge shell. A flare gun. She'd seen only one in her life, the time she and her parents had taken a coal-fired ferry boat that chugged between Ludington, Michigan, and Manitowoc, Wisconsin. The captain had shown her his flare pistol when he gave them a tour of the pilot house. His flare gun had been orange plastic. This pistol was metal and looked old and worn. She thumbed the release and broke the weapon open the way she would a single-shot shotgun. The barrel housed a removable metal insert. Opening the baggie, she shook out the shell. The cap was brass, the cartridge red, with BAM-PM-1-060-062 stamped in black. Below that was the word caliber, and then the numbers 12/70. On the back was the word Signal Patronen, also in black. No way she was leaving this behind. And where are you, Darth? Her heart gave an unpleasant lurch as she did a peek around the bureau just in time to see her guard zipping his fly. Hell, her pants weren't exactly skinnies, but someone might notice a pocket bulge. Slipping the shell into the barrel, she quickly shoved the flare pistol beneath her sweatshirt and flannel into the small of her back, then fluffed out her parka. You're crazy, you're nuts. One good whiff of that pistol and you're dead. She was about to push up from the still-open drawer, but hesitated, her attention still pinned by that bizarre hospital smell. Something's still there. Peering into the very back of the drawer, her eye ticked to a fluffy, feathery red splotch. She made a swiping grab, and her hand closed around a very slim plastic tube that she instantly knew was both too narrow and too long to be a spare cartridge for the flare gun. In the 8 seconds before Darth clumped to the door, she had enough time to think how strange it was to find a flare pistol beneath a stack of jeans. Although she could wrap her head around it, this was a boathouse. When you were out on a boat and needed help, you got off a flare. The fact that there was no boat was a little strange. Didn't the gun belong where you might conceivably need and use it? Why hide it? And now here was another puzzle squirreled away and under wraps, just like the signal gun. A common hospital item in an uncommon place. All she could think as she stared was, Peter, what the hell? Because what she held in her hand was a fluid-filled syringe. Chapter 62. The way Hannah told the story, it was a wonder anyone made it off that boat alive. The watertight fiberglass hull meant the wood beneath was dry as kindling, a fire waiting to happen. Hannah was on deck at the time, propped against the pilot house, her eyes closed against the wooziness in her head and the heave of her stomach. It was so cold I was turning blue. She lay there, shivering, until Simon peeled out of his jacket and draped that around her shoulders. wouldn't want you to catch your death, was what she remembered him saying. She'd just opened her mouth to thank him when there was a huge bang and something hot and white suddenly blasted through the hull not 5 feet from her face. After that, Hannah's memories were a chaotic blur, screaming kids stampeding from below, flames shooting first out of the forepeak and then the hatch, the boat taking on water, the electrical failing a second after Peter, sobering fast, got off a Mayday. There was a life raft, but it was designed for 8, not 12. Once Simon and Peter got the raft into the water, keeping people calm enough not to swamp it was another nightmare, especially when Peter's boat began to sink.
It wasn't dark yet, but the water was so black Peter used a flashlight. That boat filled and rolled pretty fast. Once you were in the water, you really couldn't see, had no idea which way was up. I don't think he or Simon realized Penny and another kid weren't there until they did a head count, Hannah said. By then, the fire was out, but the boat had disappeared.
Both frantic, Peter and Simon jumped out of the raft and swam back to the spot where the boat had gone down. What happened next was a little hazy, was how Hannah put it. As Peter later told it to the Coast Guard, he and Simon dove a good 15 or 20 feet, grappled their way through what was left of the hatch, and surfaced in the skeletal remains of the engine room. The remaining air pocket was tiny, no more than a 10-inch gap. Numb with cold and nearly exhausted, Penny was treading water that was up to her chin. The other girl, a townie no one really knew except for the boy who'd brought her aboard, was already dead.
Peter told them the other girl must have gotten snagged on something that held her underwater, Hannah said. Simon said the same.
Who was she, the girl who died?
Amanda Peterson? No, Pedersen.
She paused.
You know, I remember that at the time there was one thing I thought was weird. As soon as the boys got Penny to the surface, Peter screamed at Simon to take care of her and not follow, and then Peter dove back under on his own, and he was gone a long time. I thought he'd drowned.
Why would that be weird? He asked. He probably tried to get that girl's body out.
I guess.
Smoothing back her hair with one hand, Hannah rose to go.
Maybe you had to be there, but I know something happened down there in that boat. I just don't know what.
Why do you think that?
Because Peter never came back to school, she said, and about 6 months later, Simon tried to kill himself.
Chapter 63. Plopping down on the last step up from the boathouse, Alex decided to steal a few minutes to spaz in private. Chugga chugging ahead like the little asthmatic engine that could, Darth was already halfway to the house. Or maybe he was daring her to run so he could shoot first, eat second, and ask questions later.
You have lost your mind, honey.
She propped her back against a knotty red pine. The pistol knuckled her spine. She'd slipped the capped syringe into a right cargo pant pocket. What was she thinking? Wolf always slept close. If he sniffed or felt that pistol, she was sunk. So far, all her grand schemes had been pipe dreams of an oh-so-daring getaway, but now she had a real weapon, two if she counted the Tanto. That funky syringe she wasn't sure about. The more she mulled over that feathery thing, the more she thought, fletchings. Was this some kind of dart? But no kidding around this time. Execute this just right, blind someone, set a few changed on fire. She could swipe a couple rifles, have herself some real guns. For that matter, she could have shot Darth right then and there. Of course, a 12-gauge shell in a tiny little gun had to be loud. Still, she could have grabbed his rifle and skedaddled before anyone knew what was going on. If she really wanted to throw a monkey wrench into things, set the house on fire. Those propane canisters she'd found, combined with popcorn-dry, resin-rich pine, certain to throw off a ton of sparks? What's not to like?
So what's wrong with me? Wolf's not here.
So it wasn't a question that she might hurt or kill him. But whoever was left standing might take it out on Wolf. That would be on her.
And so what?
Tired of this endless mental rat race, she reached into her parka, withdrew the candy bar, inhaled memories.
Jump, sweetheart.
I agree, Dad. She slid another nibble of candy onto her tongue. Live a little. Why care about Wolf? How long was she supposed to be grateful? Wolf was not Chris. She was starting to think like those kidnap victims. What was it? Stockholm Syndrome?
Sympathy with the devils, more like it.
She worried coconut between her teeth.
What is this? I kissed a zombie and liked it? He ate part of your shoulder, for God's sake. So what if he protects you now? He put you in this position.
She suddenly stiffened.
Hello?
That familiar and yet very weird scent, wolf and not wolf, was very close, much more so than ever before. Dead ahead, in fact, and practically in her lap.
Oh, shit.
Did it sense easy prey? Here she was, alone, in the open. What help she might count on, ha, was too distant to do her any good, if Darth even bothered.
Just be calm.
The scent hadn't deepened to, and oh, what big teeth you have, but she felt her heart giddy up in a spastic gallop. She inched her eyes, sweeping up from untrammeled snow to the denser green of the woods and a screen of low cedar. And it was right there, so perfectly still that were it not for its scent, she'd never have known where to look.
What,
she thought,
are you?
Chapter 64.
A flare gun?
Sighing, Chris massaged his aching temples and let himself sink more deeply into the bed.
What the hell had Penny been thinking?
He was alone again, Hannah having locked him in almost a half hour ago, according to the old clock. He could hear her moving around in the kitchen downstairs, caught the chatter of plates and chinks of glass as she put together food to take out to Isaac in the lambing barn. His own lunch still waited. He should probably eat, but the prospect of dragging himself off the bed made him groan and pull a pillow over his eyes to blot out the bright afternoon light. After 2 weeks spent dreaming, he'd have thought he would never want to lie down again. Yet the creep of a deep weariness was too powerful to ignore, the bed very inviting, and he needed some time to digest all this. Having burned so bright and hot, Peter's boat sank fast in water over 500 feet deep. Neither it nor the dead girl were ever recovered, and so they joined the litter of wrecks at the bottom of the largest and deepest of the Great Lakes, which meant that Peter's story, an engine room fire ignited by an electrical short, never could be investigated. According to Hannah, the Coast Guard and then the police questioned them but got nowhere. Simon was the only eyewitness who hadn't been drinking, and he backed up Peter.
"I knew what I'd seen," Hannah had said, "but it all happened so fast I kept thinking I might be wrong. I didn't know it was even a flare until Simon finally told me. Can you believe Penny still had the gun? After she shot it off, she crammed everything into her pockets."
From below came the muted thump of a door, Hannah leaving for the barn. The silence settled. His clock ticked off the seconds. Why Hannah kept in touch with Simon was a mystery. All she said was, "We got close." Even so, Simon's suicide attempt was a shock. But Chris could see it. He understood the impulse.
"Your father kills his girlfriend."
Chris hugged the pillow to his eyes.
"You, the little kid, help him hide the evidence. You lie to the police because your dad says it's the only way."
He remembered that, too. His father reeking of booze, the smell of blood wreathing him like a fog.
"They'll split us up, boy. Put you in a home where there won't be no one to give a shit about you. You want to be safe? You don't want boys and old men doing filthy things to you? You want a roof over your head? Then this is what you're going to say. This is what you're going to do."
"Shut up, Dad," Chris muttered. "It was never about me. It was always about protecting you. And keeping secrets until you wake up one day to find you live with two monsters. The one with your dad's face and the thing rotting inside..."
"Chris!"
The sound of his name felt unreal, like the slash of an exclamation point at the end of a sentence you hadn't realized you'd written. The sound was short and sharp, like knuckles on a door, and knocked him from his thoughts. Before he could reply, he heard the doorknob rattle. "Come in," he said, not moving from the bed. Probably Hannah, back from the barn, wanting his dishes. When he didn't hear the hinges complain, he waited a moment. "Hannah?" The knock came again. This time he tossed the pillow with a groan. "Hang on," he said, swinging his feet to the floor. That was when he remembered. "I can't unlock it from my side." Hannah said something he didn't catch. "What?" he called. She said something else, but her voice was muffled. There was another rattle, followed this time by the scrape of the bolt. Without thinking much about it, he turned the knob and pulled open the door. Sorry, I was everything in him. His brain, his breath and blood, the thump of his heart stopped. There, her lime-green scarf still twined around her neck, was Lena. Chapter 65. Alex had been right. It was a wolf, and it wasn't. Some kind of hybrid. This animal was much larger than even a Malamute, but without the curly-cue tail. Its fur was virtually white, with only streaks of gray. The shape of the head, snout, and ears reminded her of Jet, Chris's black German shepherd, but the facial markings and light black mask resembled a husky. Why show itself now? Was that because of the candy, what it thought was an offer of food? Possibly, but the scent wasn't right. Like the alpha wolf, this animal's scent didn't scream hunger or danger. Over the lingering sweetness of chocolate and coconut, she could taste the emptiness here, all cold dust and gray ash. This wolf dog was both alone and lonely. But where did you come from? For that matter, why had it risked following her? Maybe it was like the dogs before, how they always clamored to be near and protect her, if need be. They stared at one another. Unlike Jet, the wolf dog's eyes were an intense, stunning gold. Only after they'd locked gazes did she remember that it was dangerous to stare down a wild animal. Yet as their eyes held, that lonely taste again washed over her tongue. Her chest ached. It had been a long time since she'd seen a dog. Even a wolf dog was somehow more normal. It made her feel human. Moving slowly, she swiveled her head to the right. Head jutting like a Neanderthal's, Darth was clomping past the wraparound porch, heading for Bert and Penny, who were just emerging from the woods. From the crinkly nip in the air, she knew they'd hauled back mostly desert dry pine, which she, oh joy, would then sort through, because these kids just didn't learn. Pine plus fire equals big trouble. But this meant she had a few more minutes. She turned back to the animal.
"Hey, boy, what you doing?"
she said softly, knowing better. This was something poor, cranky, sweet little Ellie would have done.
"Hey, strange animal, come give me rabies."
The thought pushed a lump into her throat. If Ellie magically reappeared, she could make nice to every animal in the forest, and Alex wouldn't bat an eye. She should know better, too. Given Wolf's interesting fetish, encouraging this animal to stick around was a death warrant. But she suddenly longed to touch it, just ruffle her fingers behind its ears. Selfish, she knew, but she really, really needed this.
"Hey, boy, what you doing? You stealing my food, huh?" "That's okay," she soothed, and saw the tip of its tail twitch back and forth. "Relax, breathe out, let go so it can. But next time, you think you might leave me some..."
There was a sudden urgent push in her head, a kind of mental shove in the center of her brain. A split second later, she felt a heaving sensation that was like the unfolding of arms and legs, the swiveling of a gigantic head, the baring of needle teeth, the opening of yellow eyes. What the hell? Her mind shimmied as if the ground were shifting under her feet, the snow ready to let go and carom down a rise and sweep her away. Gasping, she flinched away, nearly tumbling down the steps, barely aware of the wolf dog's small, queer yip of alarm. The monster? Why was it waking up now? Not because of Wolf.
There was no way to get used to a monster, but she was beginning to sense a difference in what the monster did. Never fully asleep now, the monster always poked its nose up for a sniff whenever Wolf was near. That feeling was close to her dream. Fire and need, desire. The monster reaching out in a lover's embrace because it wanted Wolf. But this was different.
It's like that night Spider killed Jack when I got yanked behind her eyes. Like when Leopard wanted me in the mine.
And just days ago when Acne tried to kill her. This was bloodlust, a killing frenzy. There was something, someone, pulling at the monster, reaching in with clawed hands, dragging it along and into a mind that isn't hers, behind alien eyes.
Push, push, go, go, in a body she didn't recognize. Push, 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 and isn't sure belongs to a girl. Go, go, push, push. She, he, it is moving with four others, just as fast and silent, and go, go, go.
A red storm. Push, push, over the snow, through trees. Push, push, push. A swirl she, he, it sees through many eyes.
To its left, there are bright flashes of sun dazzle shining through breaks in the forest. That portion of the forest curves, following a broad swath, rimming a bowl of unbroken snow. Behind, not very far, there is the push, push, go, go! And there is another, almost a brother, but still an enemy, and that one is screaming, go, 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 let me!
Very far ahead, there are six more, and the red storm drives, push, push, push them on, go, go, go! And then what she sees, and where she is, collapses. There is another shimmy, a shift. Now suddenly she's jumped again to slip behind the eyes of someone else, who is chasing after three others.
One has a head of wild, untamed hair, another is small, and his pain is a bright, bright scent. And there is a third, but he, it, is hard to read. There is nothing to roll around the mouth, but push, push, push. Her head is a red storm full of go, 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 push, push, push!
Now, part three of Monsters, written by Ilza J. Bick and read by Catherine Kellgren. Chapter 66.
Chris felt his mind try to push back, run away, but he could only stare, frozen, petrified.
Lena was skeletal, all sharp angles and tinted skin. Sunken in their sockets, her dull eyes were smudged with hollows the color of old coffee. Except for the scarf, her clothes were torn, filthy, matted with forest rubbish. Her thick hair was a tangle of dead leaves and broken twigs.
Lena!
Her name came in a wild, strangled choke. His heart suddenly kick-started in a chest that felt too narrow, his lungs squeezed between iron walls.
Where? How?
She said nothing, and for a split second he thought,
she's not real. This is a trick. You feel guilty. That's...
Then his eyes, the only working parts of him, it seemed, hooked on the bright lime-green scarf.
Oh, God.
His head ballooned with horror.
The last time I saw that was the night we stayed in that school when the changed came.
Chris had stolen Lena's scarf and deliberately placed it in a pile of bodies.
Because I wasn't sure what was happening to her.
He remembered how his stomach had bottomed out when that boy, a changed, wrapped Lena's scarf around his neck. But now Lena had her scarf, and that meant...
Wait!
He tried to step back, but his feet wouldn't budge.
Lena,
with no sound at all, she came at him, a blur of clawed hands and teeth. No! Flailing, he scrambled bolt upright, thrashing his way off the bed, thumping to the floor hard enough to rattle the windows. Gasping, he sprawled on his back. His chest was drenched, his hair clung to his scalp.
Relax. It was a dream,
he said to the ceiling. He armed clammy sweat from his forehead.
Just a dream.
God, but so real, like the nightmares. His eyes crawled to the nightstand clock. Only 5 minutes had passed. Except for the clock, the house was dead quiet.
Dozed off.
Pushing to a sit, he propped himself on his hands.
Why do I keep dreaming about you, Lena?
He whispered. This was going to eat him alive if he wasn't careful. Groaning, he rolled to hands and knees, then got a leg under, pushed to his feet, and staggered to the south window. The frozen pond was a golden oval. A long rectangle of blue-black shadow cast by the house stretched toward the far barn. The corral was empty, all the cows probably inside for the afternoon milking.
Stop feeling sorry for yourself, Chris. Take a chance like you did with Alex. Stop hiding, he said to the room. He palmed chill glass. For God's sake, you're not 8 years old anymore. Tell Hannah or Isaac about Lena and Alex, but tell someone. Just do it. If they understand, they understand. If they don't, well, they wouldn't kill him to protect themselves, would they? His forehead crinkled with sudden disquiet. No, that was crazy. Would he, if the situations were reversed? No, he said. He'd give a person like him some supplies, then blindfold and lead him far away, point him in the right direction, and wish him luck. If Hannah and Jaden were smart, they'd move and never give him the chance to retrace his steps. Leaving all they'd built up would be hard, but they were strong, tight, they'd manage. First chance he got, he should leave. There was nothing more he could do here or discover. No army of willing children, either. If that was Jess's plan, then she was insane. These were only kids trying to survive. He couldn't force them to come back, wouldn't even ask. As for the rest, all those secrets, okay, now he knew. Yay, and so what? The only unanswered question was whether the people in rule suspected what Peter and the council were up to and just kept their mouths shut. Did he really care enough to risk going back to dismantle the zone, take on the council? Maybe so, but not for them. The kids Peter and I brought back. They didn't have a say. You can't let them grow up in the shadow of that. What kind of people will they be in the end? Of all people, he should understand what it was like to grow up with ghosts and blood that never washed away. His stomach picked that moment to grumble, an incongruous sound that made him laugh. He ought to eat up. This might be his last good meal for a long time. Just as he turned from the window, his eyes hooked on a very slight shift in the light, some dark slink out of the corner of his eye. He shot a quick but offhand glance, more from habit than anything else. Two boys, Jaden and Connor, he thought, hurried over the snow toward the barn. Oh, was all the thought he gave them, because he was preoccupied, focused on food and how to break the news about Lena and Alex before heading back to rule. South was best, a straight shot that wouldn't take him but 4 days on foot, three if he hustled. Hunter said they had Nathan's gear, a lucky break. He could listen in with the radio, figure the best way to slip into the village without getting his head blown off. The stew was stone cold, the glutinous sauce clinging to chunks of potato and carrot and venison. He shoveled in a mouthful. The meat tasted a bit musty, gamey, and it was tough. Probably an older buck, or Jaden might not have dropped it right away. Peter once said that the longer a deer ran after it was shot, the gamier it tasted because of the acid buildup in muscle, he said out loud around stew. Wait a minute. What did I just see? Leaning back, he carefully replaced his spoon in the bowl, replayed the view from his window. Two boys heading for the barn. And this was a problem because, he swallowed, they were hunting. So if Jaden and Connor were hunting and checking trap lines, where's the game? He said to his room. Well, they might not have bagged anything, right? Everyone has bad days. But hadn't Hannah said that Jaden never came back until he'd gotten something, that he always pushed the envelope and this scared the hell out of her? Then Chris realized what he hadn't seen. Oh, shit! His chair toppled as he darted back for the window. It's not only that they don't have game, they don't have guns! The boys were much closer to that far barn now. No guns, no horses, no game. But that was because they were still on the hunt. And instead of only two changed, now there were 10. Chapter 67 Go, go, go!
Alex could hear herself now, but the sound was tiny in her mouth, the red storm still huge in her mind. Push, push, she said, unseeing the words falling off her tongue. Push, 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 go after them, go faster, go! A jolt of pain raced up her right thigh. Grunting, she hissed out a breath as she felt whatever had grabbed the monster in her head suddenly let go. She looked up to see Darth, who was just winding up for another kick. "Stop, Darth, stop," she said, laboring to her feet. "I'm getting up, okay?" Yet for once, she was almost glad to see him. God, what the hell was all that? She put an absent hand to an itch on her upper lip, then felt her thoughts stutter as her eyes fell first to her glove and then jumped to the step. Red spiders spattered the snow. Oh, no. A clot of fear wedged in her chest. The last time she'd had nosebleeds, the monster had chewed up enough real estate to double in size. Maybe the red storm, that push, 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 was nothing other than the monster, now stronger and bigger, ripping up her brain. So maybe that's what happened just now. The monster's developed to the point where it can do this... Well, whatever had just happened, she didn't even know what she could call it. Darth nudged her again, this time with the business end of the rifle. "Yeah, yeah," she said, snuffling back blood. As she began trudging across the cut to the driveway, however, Darth moved on ahead again, and she was able to flick a quick look toward the clutch of low cedar. At first, she thought the wolf dog was gone, but then spotted it well back, mostly hidden in the dense shadows beneath a blue spruce. And how weird is that? Darth didn't seem to notice or care about this animal. With those carcasses standing as ritual sentinels here and Wolf's cowl, Darth must have known the animal was there. Unless this was only Wolf's peculiar little fetish, his spirit guide or whatever, that Darth and the others put up with. She turned her thoughts back over what she'd just experienced. What would she call that? A mind jump? Or someone else dropping in? Both? Think, Alex, how did it start? She'd been with the wolf dog, but no, that wasn't quite right. The mind jump had happened when she relaxed to coax the animal closer. She'd let down her guard, and then either her monster got out, or something, someone, grabbed it. Which meant what, exactly? Her monster always woke up when Wolf was around. So Wolf could be on his way back, and she'd gotten a kind of subliminal whiff of him, one she hadn't really noticed or paid attention to because she was so used to the changed. That was possible. She had no idea what the range of her spidey sense might be, and it was probably dependent on the wind, which was relatively still at the moment. But Wolf might be nearby. One eye on Darth, she slowed and sampled the air, letting it whisk over her tongue. All she got, however, was the copper of her blood, pine, snow, the evanescent coil of the wolf dog, no wolf. Okay, scratch that idea. Unless Wolf's on his way back and the monster knows this somehow. Yeah, but how would that work? Maybe the same way you got a premonition about someone and then your cell would ring? Which would mean that her monster was syncing up in some funky way with Wolf? Well, honey, I hope that's not it. Her breath rose in a tangle of mist that the breeze picked apart. But what did I see? What was that? Turning away from the house, she stared back down the hill at the lake. She just couldn't put a finger on... Wait a minute. She squinted against the yellow glare bouncing up from unbroken snow over icy water. I saw this. A feeling of unreality swept through her. It's not the same perspective, but if that was the lake... During the mind jump, I saw the lake on my left, so that means I was coming from the west. Her eyes widened, and I saw three kids way ahead running away. No, that's not quite right. Push, 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 she whispered, her eyes watering against the light. Go, go, go. What did that mean? Think it through, Alex, come on. First, she and the monster had jumped, been pulled into someone, a boy, a changed, brimming with the single-minded urgency and intensity of a pursuit.
He'd been with that red storm, the push-push-go-go. There'd been someone else, too, screaming, "Let me go, go, go." But then her perspective had shifted. I jumped ahead and into someone else, another boy. The feeling she'd gotten then was also different. Not only the push-push-go-go, but a sense of being driven and pushed after two, no, three other changed, the way old-style cowboys might herd cattle. Two she'd seen pretty clearly, that lanky kid with the wild hair and a shorter, smaller... "Oh, my God," she breathed. "Alex, you idiot! That was Marley, which means the smaller kid has to be Ernie. And that means those other changed are all chasing..." The afternoon cracked open with a shot. Chapter 68.
Hannah!
Chris beat the window with his fist. Below, on the snow, and now much closer to the barn, the changed were splitting up, five right, five left, coming at them from both sides. He slammed the thick double-paned glass again.
Hannah! Hannah!
Stupid, useless, what are you doing? He had to get out of the room. His fingers fumbled with the window latch, but it wouldn't budge. And a second later, when he saw the slot for a key, he understood why. A lock? Whoever had built this room really didn't want anyone getting out. So either break the window and clamber down that trellis or kick open his door. Neither was great, but the window would be faster. Scraping up his chair, Chris grabbed the legs, wound up, and swung. He felt the impact in his wrists as the high split rail back banged glass before bouncing back. The panes were seamed with a sudden silver tracery of cracks like a psychotic spider's web. Roaring in frustration, he swung again. This time the panes shattered with a tremendous crash, the chair's ears and top rail smashing through. Whipping up cloth napkins Hannah had used to cover his food, he wrapped his fists, knocked hanging daggers out of the way, and bellowed, "Hannah! Hannah, look out! Look out! Isaac! Isaac!" Across the snow, he saw that steady, deadly stream of change suddenly come to a dead stop. They were too far away for him to make out faces, but he could see when they twisted to look back at the house. Good, good! He'd slowed them down, at least for a second. Cupping his hands, he screamed, "Hannah! Han-" The barn's west door suddenly swung open. A head appeared, a froth of white above broad shoulders. "Isaac!" Chris bawled. "Barricade the doors! There are 10! There are 10!" The old man's head jerked back as the barn door snapped shut hard enough for Chris to hear the faint clap and then its echo. Okay, he'd warned them, now to help them. Crossing to the door, he hesitated, studying the jamb, that lock. God, a deadbolt? Whatever, just do it. Backing up, he aimed his right shoulder, grabbed his right arm with his left, then charged. He hit the door hard enough to feel the impact in his teeth. His shoulder let out a bark of pain. The door, solid oak and stout, shivered, but there was no splinter or scream of wood. He hammered the door again, and a third time, a grunt jumping past his teeth. By the fourth time, the bark in his shoulder was a roar, and still the door held tight. Damn it! Cold air gushed through the shattered window. His puffing breaths plumed as he planted his fists on his hips and tried thinking past the ache in his shoulder. Maybe have to climb out the window after all. That was when he noticed what he should have seen at the very beginning. This door locked from the outside, but swung in. Hinges! He spun back to the table. Hannah hadn't given him a knife or fork, but... "There is no spoon," he said giddily, sweeping that up along with one of Hannah's books. The spoon was heavy stainless steel and would break before it would bend. Wedging the handle under the hinge pin's flat top, he beat it with the book spine. To his surprise, the pin let out a metallic squeak after only a few blows and jumped a half inch from the knuckle. "Come on," he grunted, beating the spoon. The pin hitched another half inch. "Come on, come!" The unmistakable crackle of gunfire came through the broken window. He froze, heart thumping. Another shot, the distant bawl of cattle and bray of horses. "Shit, got to get out," he said, using his fingers to pry the pin the rest of the way. The hinge uncoupled, and now he could see a gap between the top rail and frame. "One more, then I can just tear it down." Dropping to a crouch, he braced his shoulder against the jamb, rocked the now nicked handle beneath the head of the middle pin. This time there was more resistance from the weight of the door. His left hand ached from his death grip around the spoon. His right wrist was throbbing. The spoon had punched and then cut a crescent moon through the book's cloth-bound cover and a quarter inch of pages. Thank God it wasn't a paperback! And then he wondered if he wasn't getting just a little hysterical. More spackles and muted pops of gunfire, and now he was talking to the pin. Let go, let go, let... Shooting straight up from the middle hinge, the pin popped free to clatter to the floor. Shoving the spoon into a back pocket, Chris flung the book aside, then wrapped his hands around the edge of the door and put his weight into it. The butt hinge cried in a long, high squall before giving way all at once. Raking the door aside, he bolted into the hall. His room was at one end, two doors on his right, one on his left, and a little beyond that, a short banister marking the head of the stairs. Wheeling around the newel post, he pounded downstairs. Through pebbled glass sidelights on either side of the front door, he could see a huge porch he hadn't known was there because his room was at the back of the house. To his left was an enormous front room with several long benches that looked like some kind of meeting room. He spotted a swinging door at the far end. Jesse's house had a door just like that, between the kitchen and parlor. Grab a knife! Sprinting across the front room, he straight-armed the pushplate, banging the door aside. Maybe a poker from the wood stove! The kitchen was on the southeast corner of the house, same as Chris's room, and already going thick with shadows. Directly ahead were eight chairs ranged around the long oval of a butcher block pedestal table draped with a light blue tablecloth and set for a meal, probably a late dinner for Jaden and Connor. An ornate, old-fashioned kerosene wick lantern with a frosted shade and green glass base stood in the center. To the right was a black cast-iron cook stove on a square of raised red block with a box of oak splits, a pail for ash, a brush, and shovel. On the stove a saucepan steamed. Three iron pots and two large skillets dangled from a pot rack. Beyond the kitchen table were oak cupboards, a butcher block bristled with knives. The way out was a door with floral chintz to the left of an old-fashioned refrigerator. Then he registered what he hadn't a split second before. The room wasn't toasty warm, and it wasn't freezing, but there was a lingering raft of cold air, as if someone had just gone out or come in. That also was when he noticed how the flowery curtains over that kitchen door still swayed. Not a lot, but enough. It dawned on him then. The kitchen was right below his room. Whenever Hannah worked in here, he heard her. So when he'd shouted his warning, he'd shown the changed exactly where, in which corner of the house, they should start looking. A small shuffle right behind him. Chapter 69
Rifle, Alex knew from that distinctive whip-crack. Close, coming from the west.
Before the first echoes had died, she was pelting up the hill.
Penny, get in the house! Get in the house!
The smell was rolling from the woods, too. Not only that familiar scent of cool shadows, but a rancid fug of desperation.
It's Wolf, close enough to smell now.
Wolf was in trouble, maybe hurt. She felt herself reaching out to him before she even realized what she was doing, and deep in her brain the monster again shuddered to life, her thoughts slipping sideways. In an instant she was both in her body and elsewhere, seeing through Wolf's eyes, tangy fear in her mouth, sour sweat on her chest. Ahead the house was coming together out of the trees, light winking off windows like beacons.
Something heavy, the sack, tried to slip off her shoulder. Only it's not me.
Her head was huge, yet everything that was her felt very far away, like Alice shooting up after nibbling that eat-me cake. Alex was in here and out there with Wolf. The air crackled with more gunfire. The sound socked her back into her own head. They're heading straight for us. Her stomach double-clutched with dread.
Move, move, move!
She sprinted for the house. Ahead, Penny and Bert were just scuttling inside, though Penny was awkward, slow. Darth grabbed the girl's arm and reeled her in. As Alex tore up the last few steps, the big boy clamped a hand the size of a ham on her shoulder and heaved her the final 10 feet.
She gave a startled yelp as she hurtled past the threshold to crash onto hardwood. Wait! Scrambling up, Alex wedged herself between the door and jam before Darth could slam it shut. He might not understand, but speech was all she had. Even Darth would get her meaning. They're almost here! Those shots are close! Give Wolf a chance! She could tell he didn't want to do it, smell it fuming through his pores, but his arm relaxed. A minute, maybe more like 30 seconds. She tossed a wild glance around the room, trying to figure out the best cover. This great room was sparsely furnished, fireplace and wood stove on a brick pedestal to the left, leather couch and two upholstered armchairs on an oval rug in the center to catch the view from that big picture window. Not enough to really barricade the door, and trying to take cover in this great room would be suicidal. That sofa wouldn't stop a spitball. With that picture window, they'd be like fish in an aquarium. Her eyes flitted past Penny, who'd retreated behind a long breakfast bar on which Alex had stashed the camp stove, Coleman lantern, and spare fuel canisters. The girl had the right idea. The kitchen was further back, and that window over the sink gave them a way out. Topple the refrigerator, and she could take cover there. Second best would be up those stairs at the extreme right, which emptied into an open loft and then a short hall, down which was a bathroom and two bedrooms, one right, one left. Easier to defend, but just as easy to get themselves trapped. Kitchen, then. It was closer, and she liked the look of that back window more and more. Without a weapon, she couldn't help defend the house anyway. She had a brief moment to wonder why she would help them all together, and then thought, got a better chance with Wolf than the guys after him. Streaming past Bert, who clutched a 12-gauge but was otherwise rooted to the spot, she dashed into the kitchen. There was a freestanding refrigerator on the left, an old retro model, aqua and white with a chrome handle. She'd already searched inside and found only 4 toxic eggs and a gray-green jungle fuzz that the jar claimed once was mayonnaise. Now, squirming into the gap between the wall and fridge, she braced her back, tucked her knees, planted her feet, and gave the fridge a hard shove. The refrigerator lurched and then toppled, slamming down with a thunderous crash. From deep in its metal guts came the smash of glass and clang of shelves. A second later, the gassy, fecal gag of fungus and gooey dead chick. "Penny, over here!" Springing for the breakfast bar, she grabbed the girl's wrist. With a startled Penny twisted away. "Stop it!" Alex panted, hauling the thrashing Penny the way she would a stubborn toddler. "You want to get shot? Get behind the refrigerator! Get!" From across the room came the shriek of hinges. Marley blew through the front door on a blast of wintry air and a swirl of dreads. Swiveling, he socked his rifle home and got off another shot as Darth also opened up against the spack and crackle of more weapons fire. "Wolf! Where's Wolf?" "Get down!" Shoving Penny behind the refrigerator, she ducked back into the great room. She heard the pock as a slug drilled into the heavy oak door and showered splinters. "Marley! Where's—" A second later, and to her horror, she had her answer as the boys blundered up the steps. A lumpy sack hung over Wolf's left shoulder. His right arm was wrapped around Ernie. As the two staggered inside on a fresh fusillade of snaps, the drone of bullets whirring overhead, she got a good look. Wolf's face was whiter than bleached linen and covered in blood. Chapter 70. Chris didn't turn. He barely thought. Maybe his mind had already ticked through the math and realized that facing whatever lay behind would only waste time or make him freeze. Chris dodged right. Out of his left ear, he heard a quick inhale, the sudden stomp of a boot, sensed something rushing in from the side. A hand whisked through his hair. Ducking, Chris raked the first chair he came to, flinging it without turning around. He heard the clatter of wood on the floor, and then the stutter of boots as whatever was back there bumbled into the chair. But whoever, whatever it was, didn't fall. A second later, a huge hand snatched at his neck, got a fistful of shirt collar and the tight silk thermal underneath, and twisted. Suddenly his breath was gone. His heart began to pound as his vision reddened, first with panic and then lack of air. Flailing like a fish hopelessly snagged on a line it could not break, he got his hands up, but the silk thermal was so tight he couldn't hook his fingers. His flannel shirt ripped,
buttons popped free, pattering to the floor like jumping beans. Yet the strong silk weave only grew tauter and tighter. Whatever held him was shaking him now like a puppet. Chris heard, but only dimly, the thump and thud of his boots skating over the floor. His knees buckled. Chris felt himself falling, felt the impact of the table against his forehead as he pitched forward. Something, a lot of somethings, bounced to the floor and smashed. Plates, a glass, Chris didn't know. Although his hips and legs were on the floor, his chest wasn't flat. The hardwood was still a half foot from his nose because the changed was holding him up by that noose of silk, suspending his head and chest to allow gravity to do its thing. The changed would let Chris's own weight kill him bit by bit. What happened next was an accident. Chris's right hand closed over something. He registered that it was sharp and his last chance. Chris's fingers clutched that dagger of glass and struck. Chapter 71. No! Squirting past Bert, Alex made a diving grab for Wolf as Darth and Marley muscled the door closed. Splashes of blood painted Wolf's face and hands, and the wolf skin knotted around his neck. That lumpy sack he'd slung over his shoulder was sodden. No! For 1 second, a single terrified moment, her stupid, stupid heart turned over. No, you can't die, Wolf! You can't die! Then she realized that the blood wasn't his. Ernie's face was gray, his lips dusky. To either side of his piggy little nose, his small pellet-gray eyes rolled. His hands clutched his soupy middle. From the strong stink of iron and the liquid slop as Wolf tore open the boy's jacket, she already had a pretty good idea of just how bad this was. Ernie's abdomen was awash in gore. Some had already clotted into grape-jelly goo. Most of it was only tacky and a lot of it fresh. That was because the rips in his abdomen were ragged, wicked, and very deep, gaping wounds that began just beneath his left ribcage to slash through skin and belly fat and muscle. Bluing bags of wormy intestines bulged from 3 of the tears. The smell was gagging, round and thick and fecal. Eyeing the slow eel of a length of intestine, Alex saw how it was already beginning to bloat. She felt the knot in the pit of her gut try to erp its way into her throat. Probably hooked him first, then ripped. Teeth and nails, she guessed, which meant that Wolf's group had gotten into it with that pack on their heels. She watched as a bubbler of blood surged in a bright, fresh fountain. Tagged an artery for sure. Well, this kid wouldn't have to worry about getting an infection from all that torn bowel. The bowl of his belly was overflowing, his lips paling as his arteries emptied. A clammy sweat filmed his face and neck, and the boy was starting to shudder with shock. Her eyes tracked to that lumpy, blood-soaked sack. From the smell, the body inside was a man's this time, and there was a lot of blood but no guts, which was wrong. From experience, she knew that Wolf and his crew liked liver, loved the heart, tolerated kidneys, didn't much care for tripe. Much more to the point, though, Wolf never butchered or sank his teeth into a kill until he and his crew made it to safety. She understood why. Once upon a time, and in a different life, her dad always hung their food well off the ground in a bear bag, same as Wolf and his crew secured their supplies in that stuff sack. When you were on the trail, you didn't want unwelcome visitors making off with your stash. Why more changed didn't flock to Wolf's little hideaway like ants to spilled sugar, she didn't know. They had to smell the meat, she sure did. But the body in that sack, this man, was in pieces. He was missing several more, and here was Ernie ripped to shreds and other changed out for Wolf's blood.
You stole it from them? They caught you stealing?
And she'd been worried he was hurt? Wolf was tight-lipped, ashen, but his dark eyes, Chris's eyes, blazed. Bert, Ernie's brother, was hustling across the great room with his shotgun in one hand and her medic's pack swinging from the other. From the corner of her eye, she saw Darth lurch from the door, heading past the window for the far side of the room in an awkward crouch. For a fraction of a second, she almost bawled, "Get down, you idiot!" Darth would be as tempting a target as a metal duck in a midway. 3 hits and the little lady gets a stuffed pig.
Instead, she snatched her medic's pack from Bert and shouted, "Wolf, what do you expect me to do? I can't fix..." The picture window imploded in an enormous glassy splash. Darth's head was there one instant and red mist the next. Gasping, Alex ducked as flechettes of razor glass whizzed overhead. An instant later, someone let out a choking screech. She jerked her head around and saw Bert's hands flying for his face. A splinter of glass as long as her pinky juddered from the ruin of his right socket. Another jagged dagger had driven into the soft underbelly of his jaw. "Bert!" Horrified, she was pushing Wolf aside, even as her last snippet of common sense clamored, "Get down! Stay down!" She started for the boy. "Bert! Bert, don't touch it! Don't!" Bert let go of another blubbering shriek and his shotgun. She saw the disaster unfold in slow-mo. The jets of Bert's blood dividing into individual drops, the flash and shiver of glass, even the shotgun spiraling in a strange arabesque. Then time sped up, the eye of the barrel was looking at her, and her brain was shrieking, "Down! Get down!" A fraction of a second too late. The shotgun hit just as something crashed into her and knocked her flat. Wolf covered her up as the shotgun roared a thunderous boom. The slug burred over Wolf's head, trailing hot brass and burnt powder before smashing into drywall with a heavy thunk. More shots jetted through the shattered window. Craning past Wolf's shoulder, she saw Bert's body jitter in a spastic little dance, then drop face first. Even with the cottony buzz in her ears, she heard the crunch as the glass dagger punched bone and then brain. Bert's arms and legs shot straight out like those of a little kid yelling, "Surprise!" then went limp. At the window, Marley was springing up and down, firing wild over the sill. From the puck puck of return fire and spangs as bullets ricocheted off the cast-iron wood stove, she didn't think he hit much. "Got to hope those sparks don't ignite all that pine. Fire's the last thing we need." Ernie was a waxen doll in a blood lake. In the kitchen, Penny was screaming, "You have to get her out!" She was still pinned under Wolf, their faces only inches apart, his wolf skin so close she smelled the musty tang of the animal that had once worn it. She read his panic, smelled the sizzle of fear on his skin. If she could only get across her meaning. For a moment, she thought, "Alex, relax. Let the monster out. Let it help you." She roped back the impulse. That would be insane. Instead, she put her hands on Wolf's shoulders and grabbed his eyes with her own. "Give me a gun, Wolf. Let me help." There was another huge bang! A flash of orange light as something exploded outside. A second later, a cyclone of pulverized earth and superheated air blasted through the ruined window, knocking Marley off his feet. The room was suddenly so hot, scorching. Alex felt the burn in her throat and lungs. Above her, Wolf's body went rigid, his face tightening in a pained grimace. The air inside and out dripped with sounds and smells and sensations. The peppery sting of spent explosives, an isolated scream from beyond the window, the mucky rain of smoking globs of quivering flesh, the stutter of weapons fire. Then there was a silence, as if time had decided to take a very deep breath, and that was when Alex remembered what she had forgotten, because now she felt the sudden flare in the center of her brain. "Go, go, push, push!" The Red Storm, that strange mind, was here. Chapter 72. For 3 seconds, all Chris knew was he was face down on the floor, hacking and trying to breathe through a throat that felt as if a boot had planted itself on his windpipe and ground it to a pulp. Blood from the rip on his forehead was dripping into his eyes and coursing down his cheeks. His mouth was coppery from where he'd bitten himself, and his right hand was slick, too, the fingers beginning to burn. Over the thin, airy shrieks whistling in and out of his throat, he could hear a guttural, not coming from him, though. Blinking against blood, he managed to turn his head and felt his heart try to fail. Propped against a far wall was a boy, glittery-eyed, shaggy, a giant. Chris was tall, just an inch shy of 6 feet, but this kid had him beat by at least 4. The kid was big as a barrel, and most of that was muscle. Someone or something had gotten to the kid, though.
Huge gashes scored most of the changed face and oozed pus. His lower lip was ripped in two, the flaps drooping to expose dusky blue gums and stained teeth. The boy's hands were clapped to his right thigh. A triangle of smeary glass glimmered weakly in the thinning light, and blood was dripping to the floor. As Chris watched, the boy opened his ruined mouth and bawled again, "Oh!"
"Got to move!" Chest shuddering with every tortured breath, he struggled out of his ruined flannel, then tugged off the thermal. He'd cut his right hand on that glass dagger, but the fingers worked. Staggering to his feet, he tried to step, slipped, clutched the table for balance.
Over the drum of his heart, he heard the stomp of a boot as the boy pushed from the wall. "Oh, God." Chris turned, his hands convulsing as he swayed. If not for the table propping him up, his knees might have given way again. For a split second, Chris's mind blanked. He forgot that he wanted to fight. He was trapped, weaponless, already hurt. Less than a minute ago, he'd been as close to death as when Hannah's poison oiled over his brain. Everything he might be able to use as a weapon, pots, pans, those knives, was behind him, miles away. So he could only watch the boy, this monster, totter toward him. This was the nightmare from his memory and fever dreams of Peter and Lena, and a lifetime spent awakening to find a father reeking of booze and staring down at Chris with hate, of reading what was behind his father's red-rimmed eyes. "I'll be safe only when you're dead."
"Fight!"
Groping, Chris's hand closed over a plate. He whipped it fast in a frisbee throw. The boy saw it coming and batted the dish away, but Chris had already scraped up a glass, another dish, a saucer, tossing everything he could get his hands on, listening to the crash, hearing the crunch, trying to work his way around the table. The change just kept coming, as inexorable as fate. Despite the boy's obvious pain, Chris also thought the kid was actually enjoying this. Maybe the kid was looking forward to some payback. Tear out a chunk with his teeth, hurt Chris pretty bad, but then set him loose. "Go on, little Chris, run, bleed, see how far you get." As if finally tiring of the game, maybe he was fed up with swatting away dishes, and that thigh had to hurt. The changed boy grabbed the tablecloth and yanked. With a yelp of surprise, Chris danced out of the way as dishes and cutlery slithered to the floor in a splintery smash. The lamp's green glass fuel base burst, releasing a gagging stink of kerosene that made Chris's battered throat double clutch. Sweeping up a chair, the boy hurled it the way a basketball player pops that fast bullet of a pass. The kid's aim was perfect, the chair growing huge in his face. Startled, Chris had no time to duck. The boy's chair whacked his chest. Stunned, Chris stumbled and then came down on his back in a puddle of kerosene.
"Get up, get up!"
Retching against fumes, he kicked free of the chair. Twisting, he tried to roll, get his feet under him, scramble out of the way. From the corner of his eye, he saw the boy's knee cock and then the kick coming. Dropping flat, Chris heard the boot whiz over his head. As he rolled to his right to get under the table, Chris felt the boy clamp onto his left ankle. Frantic, Chris wrapped his hands around the butcher block's heavy center pedestal for leverage, then kicked back with his right. His boot connected with a satisfying thunk, followed a second later by a heavy grunt. As the boy's grip slackened, Chris scrambled under the rest of the way, set his feet, and squirted out the opposite side. The wood stove was in front of him, and now just to his right, and he spotted the weapon he needed, if he only had time. Whirling, Chris got his hands under the heavy table, pulled straight up, and then pushed as hard as he could. The table toppled with a gigantic bang. The change only dodged to his right, but that was all Chris wanted, just to slow the kid down for another few seconds. As the boy barreled around the table, Chris's hands shot for the wood stove and the handle of that steaming saucepan. He let out a harsh bawl of pain as hot metal scorched his palms, but he willed himself not to let go. This was the only play he had. Still screaming, Chris loosed the pot in a savage backhand.
Both a gush of water just the near side of boiling and the heavy pan hit the changed in the face. There was a hollow chunk as iron bounced against bone. A starburst of blood erupted on the boy's forehead. For a half second, the changed boy went absolutely rigid. And then, instead of a guttural, he let go of a long, high, girlish screech. Lurching backward in a clumsy wobble, the boy wallowed in a swirl of blue tablecloth and slick kerosene. Bellowing, his hands shrieking with pain, Chris charged, not for the butcher block and its temptation of fine-edged steel, but for the hanging rack. Seizing a skillet, he wrenched it from its hook. 2 feet away, the changed was kneeling, fingers quaking over flesh that blazed a hot, boiled purple where it wasn't red with blood. Skillet in hand, Chris drove forward, already certain what needed doing, knowing nothing on earth would stop him. At the last second, the changed lifted his head, and Chris saw the left eye had gone as milky as boiled egg white. From far away, another planet, came a shout, the clap of a door, his name.
Chris! Chris! Wait!
Chapter 73.
Get up! Come on! Shouldering Wolf aside, Alex squirmed out from under. A whooshing hum reverberated in her ears. The stink of cooking meat and burning hair was so heavy it was like sucking the char from a barbecue grill. Gobs of singed meat clung to Wolf's back and her hair. Marley had been flattened. His nose, eyelids, and lips were gone. Fire had chewed his dreads to the scalp. His parka was melted to his chest. Where his face wasn't parboiled, the skin was black as briquettes. His teeth, insanely white, showed in a ghastly rictus.
Easy!
A shout, muffled by the whoosh in her ears. The voice older, angry, male.
You want to kill everyone in...
Men? Were they the Red Storm or working with it? And what is that? She felt her mind shuttle, the monster unsure what to do. Even the monster doesn't know what this is. At the same time, she could feel the pull, the temptation to let go and get lost in that thrumming surge that seemed to pulse with every beat of her heart. Push, 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 go, go, go. Dropping to a crouch, she scuttled toward the front of the house and risked a quick peep through the blasted rectangle of the ruined window. What had been a snow-mantled hill before was now a smoking crater, a sore of blackened earth and smoking remains. Used some kind of grenade or bomb. It was hard to tell how many bodies, because everything was in pieces. The stub of what looked like an elbow, a foot minus 4 toes and half the sole, 3/4 of a blasted head teetering on the lip of the crater like a smashed Halloween pumpkin. Another changed, lucky or unlucky, depending on your point of view, sprawled in a twisted tangle and a halo of blood spray. What the hell? Whatever was going on here, and especially in light of the fact that there were men out here, this fight was over a whole lot more than who had dibs on what. Her eyes caught a flicker to the extreme left, the same direction from which Wolf and these dead changed had come only 5 minutes before. Something white was darting through deep green cedar and hemlock. She saw the oval of a face, but there was something wrong with it, and the smell... weird. They were changed, no doubt about it, but beneath the characteristic boiled sewage reek was another odor, harshly chemical, completely artificial. It reminded her of the metallic odor of the chemo the doctors had used on the monster, especially cisplatin, a drug that had made her puke her guts out. But why would any changed smell that way? Behind these weird changed and in the trees, she spotted other figures hanging back, got a snootful of fusty old people and horses. Men, with the changed. How can that be? Her monster suddenly quivered, straight-arming her mind with that strange shove. Go, 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 push, 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 as either it or what was out there tried snagging hold. Oh, no, you don't. Reeling back, she snatched up a splinter of glass. Not understanding, Wolf reached for her wrist, but she whirled away. No, let me just...
Grimacing, she jabbed the glass into her thigh, a quick in-out. She let out a yelp of pain, but there was an abrupt snap in the dark center of her brain as the monster recoiled. Good enough. Her mind cleared, and she looked up into Wolf's eyes, which were wide with shock. Come on, Wolf, she panted, tossing aside the bloodied glass, before we all die. Scooping up Bert's fallen shotgun and Ernie's rifle, Alex bounded into the kitchen, wheeling right to drop behind the granite counter. Racking the pump, she thought about shucking rounds to count how many shots she had left, and decided against it. The last thing she needed was to crawl after fumbled slugs. Figure one already gone, four left. The bolt action should have five, maybe six, depending on if Ernie had gotten off a couple rounds. None of this makes sense. What do they want? First, one group chases down Wolf and his gang because they've stolen food. Then those guys get slammed by these weird changed. Now they're storming the place. But why? Can't be just over food. To her right, she saw Penny's terrified eyes over the lip of the refrigerator. All of a sudden, a light bulb went off, illuminating a nasty thought she couldn't ignore. My God. Don't tell me this is about you, she said to the girl. There was a gigantic bang from the great room, followed by a squeal of stressed wood against metal as something hit the front door. The heavy oak shuddered but held. Given the sound, she thought whoever was out there had a sledgehammer or log. The air again erupted with gunfire, but this time it was close, coming from inside. Wheeling back, she saw Wolf still in the great room, but behind the overturned leather sofa. Springing up, Wolf popped off another shot, then dropped as bullets whined in. Another boom at the door. Beyond the blown-out window, she saw those weird changed dart past. Dancing from cover, Wolf sidestepped left, trying to get a shot at whoever was breaking down the door, then threw himself flat as the air rattled with another burning round of gunfire. Bullets clanked, the wood stoves flew. Miniature geysers of stone and white dust erupted from the walls and hearth as the bullets came very fast and in bursts. Automatic weapons? Wolf was still on the floor, face down, and for a fraction of a second her heart seized. Wolf! She saw the white flicker of his face as he looked her way. Wolf, come on, you can't do— Another stutter of gunfire. At the same instant, the door let out a huge crack. The wood blistered inward like a boil about to rupture, and she was so busy looking at that she only half-registered something moving into view at the broken picture window. Looking back, she saw Wolf still on the floor and a pair of gloved hands hooked over the ruined sill, trying to get inside. Wolf! Coming out from cover, Alex sprang past the counter, the shotgun already coming up. Stay down! Stay down! She fired once, muzzle flash sheeting, the slug too high, but she saw those hands let go. More bullets came ripping through to clank the wood stove. One drilled into the hearth just over her head, sending a jet of stone splinters pecking at her hair and neck. Dropping, she scrambled forward on hands and knees over jags and debris, feeling the bite of glass and tear of stone and the wash of heat from the wood stove less than 20 feet away, the icy waterfall of air spilling over the blasted sill. She swarmed over to Wolf. Either upstairs or out the back, she said, but we can't stay here. Neither option was great. If they blew out the kitchen window for an escape, they might as well take out an ad. So that left going upstairs, get to the bathroom, put Penny in the tub, and then she and Wolf could pick off whoever tried coming up. We'll run out of ammunition first. She jumped her eyes from the stairs to the kitchen, skimming past the counter cluttered with the loot she'd found in the basement. Camp stove, the lantern, propane. Still, hires pet— Wait a minute. Her gaze zeroed in again on the camp stove. The propane. Fire, she said out loud. Yes, it really might work. There was all this fresh pine. The chimney was heavy with char and creosote. This close to the hearth, the air tasted like a lump of coal. Yes, but it's also crazy. We'll be barbecued. But it was the only thing she could think of. Scurrying back to the counter, she shoveled the three propane canisters into her arms and darted back to dump them into the hearth along with the sticky pine Penny and Bert had brought in less than half an hour before. Behind and from the kitchen came another glassy explosion, followed by a girl's shriek. Penny!
Barreling into the kitchen, Alex waded over a river of broken glass from the shattered window above the sink. Bits of glass glinted from the girl's hair. Blood dribbled from her scalp and down her cheeks. "Come on," Alex said, trying to tug the panicked girl to her feet. "Penny, come on. Don't fight me. We're going." There was the whip crack of a rifle shot, the drone of a slug over her head, followed by a loud, sharp scream. Gasping, she looked up, saw the business end of Wolf's rifle pointing her way, then jerked around just in time to see an old man in a hunter's winter camouflage clap a hand to his spurting face and tumble back from the window, storming the place back and front. A moment later, the air tingled with that resin pop, and then Penny stopped struggling and broke from behind the refrigerator as Wolf dashed up from the great room to meet her. Clattering out of the kitchen, Alex pointed at the stairs. "Bathroom! Bathroom!" Behind, she heard the squall of hinges and fatiguing wood and thought they had maybe 10 seconds left. As she turned to follow Wolf and Penny, she spotted her green canvas medic pack resting on the floor near the door where it had been blown in that first explosion. She gave it exactly a millisecond's thought, then bulleted across the room, snagged the pack in a one-handed grab, and wheeled back to blast up the stairs. Peeling right, she saw Wolf kick open the bathroom door, whip aside a shower curtain, and cram Penny into the tub. Downstairs, Alex heard another smash of metal against wood, more shots, and voices. It took every ounce of willpower not to scurry after Wolf and Penny. Just a few more seconds. She felt Wolf moving up behind her, and then his hand on her arm as he tried to pull her out of his way. But his shot would have to be dead on, and there wouldn't be time for another. She looked at him. "I have something better than the rifle," she said, and then she was pulling the flare gun from the small of her bag. She read in his face and smelled in his scent the shock of recognition, and understood Wolf knew this gun. Below, she heard the door burst open. Peering around the corner, she spied three of those weird changed in camo whites and armed with what she thought were MAC-10s fanning out in the great room. In the center of her head, she felt the muted thump. "Go, go, push, push." Then she heard murmurs, voices, and spotted four old men moving in from the kitchen to meet them. "Okay, Dad." Crouching, poking the pistol between the banister rails, steadying the flare gun in both hands, she picked her spot, just like the target range. She pulled the trigger. Chapter 74 "Chris!" someone shouted. "Chris, wait, let me—" But Chris didn't stop to look, didn't stop to think, didn't stop, couldn't stop, wouldn't. Roaring, he brought the skillet around like a batter, so hard and with so much force he felt his shoulders try to pop from their sockets. The changed boy was still gawping up at Chris when the skillet connected, and the sound, already so deep in Chris's memory and his nightmares, became real again. A solid slam, the clunk of an axe biting into a tree trunk, of a hammer cratering bone and brain, of the flat of a cast-iron skillet smashing skull. The boy's head whipped to the side. Over the clamor in his head, Chris heard the sharp crackle as the neck snapped. Panting, blood painting his cheeks, Chris stood over the body as a voice boomed, "Go on, boy! Hit him again! Hit him! Go on!" "Go on," he said in a voice not his own. "Go on, boy, hit him bloody. Make him pay. You know you want. You know." Then his knees buckled as the ground opened and Chris swooned into the dark and... "Chris?" A voice in his ear, and then a shake. "Wake up. Open your eyes." "No." He was on the snow again, under the tiger trap, in a pool of blood and slowly dying, freezing to death. Everything hurt. He tried turning from the voice, but a hand hooked his chin. "I can't," he said. "It's too hard. It hurts too much to see." "Stop this," the voice said. "Open your eyes." "Why?" he asked, even as his lids creaked open. Of course, it was Jess, with her Medusa hair and black mirror eyes, Chris in the right, Chris in the left, or Simon and Simon, depending on how you looked at it. "Why is this up to me? What do you want? What good does it do me to see anything?
I can't change what's already happened. I couldn't help Alex. I didn't help Lena. Peter wouldn't let me because he never told me.
You refused to see.
Fine.
Another bolt of pain grabbed his throat.
Leave me alone, he wheezed thinly. Please, Jess, why can't you let me alone? Why won't you let me die?
Someone will die. Someone must. Without blood, there is no forgiveness.
You're dead. This is the land of the dead, and I'm having a dream. But I don't understand. I want to know what this means.
Tell me your dream, and I will tell you the truth.
And what is that?
A weak laugh dribbled out of his mouth with a trickle of blood.
What's truth?
What lives here?
She drew her fingers, cool and dry, over his forehead.
Is not the same as what resides here.
She placed a hand over his heart, and he cried out because her touch was electric, bright and awful.
Let go of the hammer, Chris. Forgive yourself. Forgive Peter.
Why does that matter?
He licked blood from his lips.
I already said I understand.
And that is why.
Another electric finger to his chest, prodding a scream.
This hurts so much. The truth of the heart is the more fearsome to bear, because from love springs grief. Truth is in your mouth, on your tongue, in your blood. Let go of your anger, Chris. Let Peter, as you remember him, speak to you.
He can't, Chris said. He's dead.
Call him back.
Jess pressed a palm over his eyes, and now he was truly in the dark again.
Quickly, Chris, in your blindness and from grief, call in love, and do it now, before it's too late, before Peter is lost, before the light goes...
Out? No, I think he's coming around. Chris? A tap on his cheek. Chris, wake up! Chris faded back, aware first of the sharp nibs of broken plates under his legs, and then the wall against his back, and finally a hand cupping the back of his head.
Chris?
Jaden patted his cheek again. Are you all right? Is this the only one? Where's everyone else? Where's...
Hannah!
His eyes snapped open. Everything rushed back like water into an empty glass.
Isaac, he wheezed again, clutching Jaden's arm. Barn!
What? Jaden shot a glance at Connor, who also crouched alongside. What are you talking about? What about the barn?
Guns!
Shots carried, especially now that there was nothing, no cars, no planes, no machinery, to mask them. How long had he been out?
Didn't you hear?
We heard gunfire,
Connor said,
but we were north. We couldn't tell where it was coming from. As we got closer, I actually thought it was coming from the east.
East? There was something important about that. No, Hannah and Isaac are in the barn, and there were chains headed that way.
What?
Connor was genuinely skeptical.
They can't find us. They've never found us.
No? Then what do you call that?
Chris said, jerking his head toward the dead giant with the misshapen skull lying in a puddle of kerosene and water dyed purple with blood. Gripping Jaden's forearms for balance, he struggled to his feet.
I counted 10. I broke out the window in my room. I know Isaac heard me and saw them. But we have to go. I heard shots, but if there aren't any now...
All right.
Jaden's skin was glassy with dread, but his mouth set as he ripped off his parka.
Take this. I'm smaller than you, but
this works.
The cuffs of Jaden's parka ended well above his wrists, and his shoulders felt like he'd slipped on a straitjacket. He jockeyed the zipper and managed to yank it halfway.
This is fine.
Okay.
Jaden looked doubtful.
You're pretty messed up. Can you fight?
Yes.
Swiping up a cloth napkin, Chris smeared blood from his forehead, then wrapped his bleeding palm.
But I need a gun.
When Jaden hesitated, Chris snapped,
Damn it, Jaden, let me help!
All right, all right. Outside in my scabbard, I've got a spare rifle.
Jaden jerked his head toward the door.
Come on.
How do you want to do this?
Chris asked as they banged out of the kitchen and down the back steps. Three horses, one loaded with four bulky game bags, had been hastily tethered to the wrought iron railing. The kitchen faced east, and the sun was well behind them now. Overhead, thin clouds scudded across blue sky on a northerly breeze. To his right, all Chris saw of the farm's southern end was the mica gleam of the frozen pond. There was also a strange whooshing, like wind, gushing through a tunnel, but he couldn't tell from which direction the sound came.
"I'm open to suggestion. It's not like we've had to fight these things the way you have."
Jaden yanked a well-used scoped Remington 798 from its scabbard.
"Loaded. Didn't fire it once today. Here."
He dipped a hand into his saddlebag and came out with a handful of bullets.
"No one's shooting now, but
shh." Frowning, Chris cocked his head, then darted a look around. The whooshing was still there, but he could have sworn there was a tinkling sound that reminded him of the fight with the changed boy, Glass.
"Did you hear that? It sounded like something breaking."
Jaden nodded. "Yeah, I did." He craned to look back at the house.
"Are you sure no one else is... Hey, Jaden?"
Connor had drifted to the house's southeast corner.
I think you guys better come here."
Jaden shot Chris a look, and then they were both running toward the younger boy.
"What is it?"
Jaden's voice was so tight it cracked.
"Is Han—"
Now that Chris was closer, he could see what he hadn't before, both because of his angle and the wind. If they'd gone out the front, or Jaden and Connor had returned even a little more to the west, they'd all have seen and smelled it right away. The mystery of why they'd both heard shattering glass was obvious, too. The barn was on fire. Chapter 75. There was a very loud crack, followed by an intensely bright burst of red muzzle flash, a pillow of acrid gray smoke as the flares streaked out of the pistol. The fusee smashed into the pile of pine and propane canisters with a kabang, and nothing really amazing happened. No explosions or fireballs. An orange-yellow rose blossomed. But that was it, for a split second, enough time for Alex to think, shit. Then there was a pop, a gasping whoosh, as if some giant had just been sucker-punched. The propane ignited with a roar. The blast, an intense neon orange, ballooned. Pine logs exploded in a shower of yellow sparks. Below, the three changed and the four men stopped dead, then turned as if mesmerized by the fire, the flames washing their features of definition, their shadows like dancing spiders on the opposite wall. Alex heard a high howl, felt the sudden rush of cold air being sucked into the now surging fire, and thought, "Oh, jeez, go!" she screamed, just as a massive gout of orange flame jetted from the mouth of the hearth. The sound of the bathroom window breaking was lost in a massive explosion like the concussion of a cannon. The chimney ruptured. A streaming pillar of fire blew out, instantly igniting the three changed in white and the old man into shrieking, writhing human torches. There was a stuttering sparkle of bullets as their weapons and ammunition exploded. Chunks of stone and masonry flew in a shower of shrapnel. The air churned hot and bright. Flares swam up the walls and spilled over the floor. A blast of hot wind whipped her hair, and she thought she might be screaming. She felt Wolf seize her by the scruff of the neck, and then he was hauling her down the hall and into the bathroom. One end of a flimsy plastic shower curtain was tied to the shower head, while the tongue fluttered from the gaping window over which he'd draped his parka. Already out, Penny was braced on her hands, feet planted wide, inching over the shingles like a pregnant fiddler crab.
"I'm okay," Alex said breathlessly. Her eardrums felt broken. "You go. Help her down. I'm right behind you."
Now that she was up here, she wasn't sure all of a sudden whether this was such a hot idea. The ground still looked really far away, and this northwest patch of the porch was glittery with ice crystals.
"Slip, and I'll break my neck."
Standing in the tub, she watched Wolf spider down to Penny, then coax her to the edge of the porch. At her back, she could feel the heat build, heard a high, eerie howl over the locomotive churn of the fire. Above the sink, a mirrored medicine chest suddenly gave way with a watery kersplash into the porcelain basin. Beneath her feet, the tub shifted and shivered, and she realized then that the house was coming down.
Get out! Get out of the house!
Hooking the medic pack onto both shoulders, she grabbed onto the shower curtain and levered herself over the sill. Glass teeth bit her rump through Wolf's parka, but then she was out, right hand still fisted around the shower curtain, the heel of the left jammed onto shingles. Now that she was on the porch, she could feel the jitter and sway. Something was bellowing, roaring like a blast furnace. Craning over her left shoulder, she caught a glimpse of an orange-yellow sword of flame, knifing from the chimney into the sky. To her right, flames curled through the shattered picture window to lick at the roof. For a horrible second, she was frozen in place, hypnotized by the dance and sputter. Any moment now, the house would collapse, and she'd still be here, clinging to the shower curtain, only to be yanked back like a yo-yo and buried under a fiery avalanche. Another tinkling smash.
Let go of the curtain! An orange geyser spumed from a bedroom window. Alex, let go!
On the porch, she saw Wolf and Penny nearly at the edge, but jouncing as the house shook.
Let go, Alex! Move!
Her mind knew what to do, but her body was locked, paralyzed.
Come on! Go! Let go!
Let! There was another belching eruption, a guttering kerpow! She saw Penny suddenly bounce, Wolf's hand flash for a grab. Something very big, a chunk of blackened cast iron, cannoned from the side of the house to shoot straight into the trees. An evergreen disintegrated into splinters. Beneath her, the house was tilting, the walls beginning to collapse, the porch crumbling. A second later, an enormous shockwave gushed up the stairs. A gigantic fist of heat smacked her shoulders and blew her out of the window. The torn shower curtain fluttering in her fist, she flew in a dizzying tumble, banging over the shingles, pinballing out of control. Screaming, she caught a glimpse of bright sky, black shingles, orange flames, and then lost all that as she smashed into Wolf and hurtled from the roof.
Chapter 76.
Chris, Jayden, and Connor raced over the snow. Belching like a coal-fired train, the barn exuded great chuffs of gray and black smoke. As they neared, Chris heard the bellows of cows and shrieks of horses. The sheep were bawling high and shrill over the pop and crackle of the fire. All the snow piled on the roof and layered on the sills had melted, and he could hear the fire complain in hissing sizzles as orange tongues licked from shattered windows.